Okay, good afternoon. We'll call to order the Committee on Judiciary for March 16, 2010. We have a quorum. The first bill on the agenda is Senate File 2725, Senator Moore's bill on gang and drug oversight council membership. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to present to the committee Senate File 2725. Mr. Chair, there's an A4 author's amendment that I would like to move to put the bill into shape I would like it to be in.
Since this is the committee of origin, Senator Moore has a A4 amendment, author's amendment, to put the bill in the shape that she desires to proceed. Discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. The A4 amendment is adopted. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill, as amended, has two components to it. One component of the bill deals with the revamping or the restructuring of the formerly known as Gang and Drug Oversight Council. The second part of the bill deals with, and the bill as introduced, was an attempt to try to deal with the data issues relating to the gang point of file system and gang net. And so there are two components to this bill. The first part of the bill would deal with the structure of the formerly known as Gang and Drug Oversight Council, and the second part of the bill would deal with a series of issues relating to data. And I'd like to take the first part first. In the author's amendment, members, if you look at the bill in front of you, there is instruction to the revisor's office to replace any reference to Gang and Drug Oversight Council with the Violent Crime Oversight Council. So throughout the first part of the bill, you will see that. What this part of the bill is trying to do here is to restructure the membership, to modify the duties of the council, and then it directs the Department of Public Safety to establish certification requirements for gang and drug task forces, which will now be called the Violent Crimes Task Forces. It also specifies membership of these task forces, the governing board, and outlines that the prosecutors will have responsibilities regarding these task forces, and it makes other clarifying and conforming changes. The bill also regulates law enforcement agencies that establish and maintain criminal gang investigative data system, which I will talk a little bit more about. And then the bill also makes other changes with respect to other databases. So if you look, Mr. Chair and members, Section 2 of the bill is the section that formally deals with the membership, the composition of the council. The number of members on the Oversight Council has been dramatically reduced down to, I believe, 15 members as written in this section. Subdivision 3 of the bill modifies some of the duties of the Oversight Council. It squarely places the Commission of Public Safety as the person responsible for the council to establish policies and procedures, and basically as the point person for oversight and responsibility. Section on page 4, section 3A, subdivision 3A of the bill spells out now the duties and authority of the commissioner, and this is the additional language that we put in place to address some of the concerns arising out of the situation this summer, where there were some concerns about operational supervision, policies and procedures perhaps that could have been tightened, and some oversight. And so this section attempts to do that. Subdivision 4, restructures the role of the state coordinator. We now require that there's a review of the annual audits that are conducted and that corrective actions be taken as a result of those audits. Subdivision 5, again, modifies the language with respect to individuals who participate in these task forces. A new section on how to handle evidence is added for oversight purposes. And then if you go to the bottom of page 5, that's where we put in the added requirement for prosecutors to participate. Let's see. The next section of the bill that changes is in subdivision 12. There are new reporting requirements or modification to the current requirement, but tightening that a little bit. And that up to page line 7.5 is the new language on the restructuring of the Oversight Council. Starting at section 3 of the bill, I would refer you now to the A4 amendment. I believe that most of the language starting at line 7.6 is basically deleted. And the new language in the A4 amendment is going to be replacing the language starting at section 3. So in the A4 amendment, we put in place a requirement regarding gang investigative systems. We're basically prohibiting gangnet type databases at the local government level. Section 2 of the A4 amendment is adding language from a bill that's currently on the agenda. And instead of taking that as a separate bill, we're just moving that bill to be included in this bill because it deals with data. And that is the traveling investigative data bill that's on the agenda. So I'm going to quickly walk through that a little bit. The language in the amendment has changed substantially from the language as introduced in the bill. We've had a number of conversations with the different stakeholders who have interest in this bill, and so the changes in this bill is to reflect some of the concerns that they have expressed. The Section 2 of the A4 amendment is an attempt to very tightly restrict this traveling data language to just investigative data. That comes from other states to the state of Minnesota. And so under this proposed language, we are saying that if investigative data comes to the state of Minnesota from another state, they will be given an equivalent data classification as that which it has in the other state. In the same Section 2, we also say, however, that if at some point, if we don't act as a state, if we don't act on that information, and if that information changes classification in the other state, then that information, the classification will also change in our state. So it stays paired with how it's classified in the other state. But once the information comes to the state of Minnesota, and if we were to act on that information, it will become investigative data for our purposes. And if it's adult information, it will now come under classified under Section 13.82. And if it's juvenile data, it will now be governed under Section 260B.171, Subdivision 4 and 5. We allow for the information to be shared among local law enforcement agencies, and we require that there be a record keeping of the information that comes to us and how we disseminate that information. Section 4 of the, on page 2, lines 2.1 to 2.3, I believe, is just renaming, is a cross section to rename the gang and drug language to violent crime language. Section 4 of the bill is Senator Foley's bill, which is also on the agenda today. And Senator Foley's bill deals with expanding a little bit what our law enforcement is currently able to do using data in our cyber system. And under current law, law enforcement is able to use the data in our cyber system to prepare a case, as in paren 1, for investigative purposes. And what we're asking here is for them to also be able to use the data in CBRS to serve process in a criminal case, to inform law enforcement officers of possible safety issues prior to the service of process, to enforce no contact orders, and to locate missing persons. And so those four uses are we're requiring for additional authority to use the CBRS data for those four additional purposes. Section 5 of the bill is a, Ms. Pontius pointed this out, that Section 5 of the bill is necessary. Ms. Pontius, can you speak to this? I don't want to be incorrect.
And this is the amendment, not the bill, right?
Yes, I mean of the amendment.
Ms. Pontius.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moy, it just because the bill's repealing that investigative data system, it strikes the reference. Right now it's a disqualifier for a permit to carry, but since the system won't be there anymore, it strikes the reference.
The gang-pointed file system that we're repealing in this bill gets cross-referenced in this section of the law with respect to the permit to carry, and so we're just striking that cross-reference in this section of the law. Okay. And then Section 6 of the bill, Mr. Chair and members, and Senator Limmer, is an attempt to address the kingfish issue that was brought up in committee the other day. And it basically just says that that local law enforcement cannot use these type of devices. And it's my understanding that our Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, however, does have this system. And so what we're trying to do here is to say that since they've already purchased the system, we expect that their use of that system will come under our wiretap law. And I think that would be a good way to impose some oversight on the use of that system. And that's the amendment and the bill.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Moy. The reference on that last discussion, page 3, lines 13 and 14, when one talks of clauses 2 and 4, I think that refers to needing a warrant or the permission of the phone user, a cellular phone user, to pursue a signal on a cell phone. Is that correct?
I believe that is the case. Ms. Pontius can confirm it for the record.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's correct. It's a warrant, a court order, or with permission of the user.
Mr. Chair, members, Mr. Nobles is here to speak about the first part of the bill with respect to the restructuring of the task force or the Oversight Council and the task forces. And then Mr. Johnson is going to is here to take questions about both the traveling data bill and the CBRS language.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor for the state of Minnesota. I think we would all agree that we went through a very difficult time with the Metro Gang Strike Force, and I think we would also agree it's time to move forward. In fact, we need to move forward during this legislative session because in state law, the Metro Gang Strike Force is still mandated to exist, even though it has been effectively shut down by the action of the Commissioner of Public Safety. As we move forward with this legislation and comparable legislation in the House, I think it is important to just very briefly remember what went wrong and what we need to correct. And I think that Senator Moy has already made reference to that. Clearly, there were individuals that failed to perform adequately in their positions. Some of them made quite serious mistakes in the management of the Metro Gang Strike Force, and some individuals may have even violated the law and committed criminal acts. But I think what to us was even more disturbing than the actions of individuals was that we had in place a structure that seemed unable to correct those problems. Because when the Office of the Legislative Auditor was asked to go in and do a review, there was acknowledgement by many people at the Metro Gang Strike Force that the problems that we were observing had been known for some period of time. but there didn't seem to be the mechanisms to require resolution. And so legislation has come forth to try and change certain elements of the structure by which we create and fund these multi-jurisdictional police operations. And again, Senator Moi referred to those. Obviously, it will be up to the members of this committee and other legislative committees to determine whether or not these actions are adequate to assure you and the public that what happened at the Metro Gang Strike Force will not happen again. But I would just echo some of the things that Senator Moi referred to, which I find going to some of the issues that were raised in our report. And certainly what we found was a breakdown in control and command, accountability and oversight. And so the first thing this legislation does is give the Commissioner of Public Safety a much stronger hand in setting binding requirements for those multi-jurisdictional police operations that receive state funding. The Commissioner actually has authority to establish standards through the Council. And then if at some point there is a multi-jurisdictional organization that is not upholding those standards, the Commissioner has authority clearly to take action. And as Senator Moi mentioned, there is a stronger role in the governing board of each multi-jurisdictional organization for a prosecutor, for a county attorney. And that is one of the things that we noted when we looked at the Metro Gang Strike Force, that it appeared that they were going out and seizing cars, cash, guns, jewels, oftentimes in part because they were worth something and they could forfeit that material and then use that money for the operation of the gang strike force. But sometimes it was unclear why they were taking some material. It didn't seem to have a monetary value. It was beyond the forfeiture statute, and it was not being used as evidence. And we felt that there needed to be a stronger role for somebody that was going to have to present a case in court against somebody whose property was being seized. And we think that kind of advice and direction from a prosecutor would be helpful. A couple of other things that are in the bill, and it relates to the requirement for the commissioner to establish standards that would clearly delineate which of the multi-jurisdictional agencies that's participating is actually in command and control of this multi-jurisdictional organization. Again, that's one of the things that we found. As multiple police and sheriff's departments came together from different jurisdictions, it simply wasn't clear who was in control. Yes, there was a commander of the Metro Gang Strike Force, but he seemed unable to adequately control the activities of the Metro Gang Strike Force. And in particular, when a new commander came in, during our review, he met with great resistance to his efforts to clean up some of the past practices. And so there is a provision here that there has to be a clear delineation that one of the participating police organizations will supply the command and control structure for the organization, as well as fiscal control as well. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I think I have ended what I think is appropriate for me to say in reference to this legislation, but I would be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Are there any questions of Mr. Nobles? Appears to be none.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you.
Senator Moi?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson is going to come up and make some comments, I think, about the traveling data and the cybers and the answer any questions that you all may have.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is David Johnson. I am the Executive Director of Minnesota Justice Information Services at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And I'd like to first speak to Section 2 of the amendment that Senator Moi presented to you. Title that is Law Enforcement Data from Other States. And the intent of this particular language is to deal with the problem of investigative data, and it's limited to criminal investigative data that comes to the state of Minnesota. As you know, that under the current data practices law, that data would be public and presumed to be public in the state of Minnesota. And because of that classification, we know that there is a chilling effect from other states and other law enforcement agencies outside the state of Minnesota in sending data into the state, and therefore not understanding how it's going to be handled and where the access may be to it. The solution to that is within the framework of this bill, and it's a very limited solution. It pertains to a limited set of data, that data that is created or maintained to prepare a criminal case against an adult or delinquency petition against a juvenile. That's in subdivision one. Secondary law enforcement is limited to government organizations, not anything outside of government organizations, performing a law enforcement function, also in subdivision one. And finally, in subdivision one, it covers both adults and juveniles and refers to crimes and acts of delinquency. When we move on to subdivision two, it recognizes that the data that is sent to Minnesota would retain the classification that it has coming from the state of origin. And it does so until that becomes a part of an investigation in the state of Minnesota. So it includes both public and not public data. It follows existing Minnesota law for adults and juveniles. How this data would be handled is also in subdivision two. In subdivision three, it provides the authority to share the data that are classified for purposes of an adult criminal investigation, for purposes of a juvenile delinquency adjudication, and clearly not for civil purposes like civil cases, background checks, or personnel matters. And finally, in subdivision four, it requires a log be kept on the receipt and dissemination of this data by any Minnesota law enforcement agency. And with that, I can certainly answer any questions the committee may have.
And Senator Moy, I note that on the agenda, the second bill apparently was the same subject as this one here. So to the extent that people had signed up to testify in that one, we'll just have them testify on this bill and this amendment then. So.
Mr. Chair, that's my intent, is that I'm going to have the people who need to testify on, in support of, or to explain the bill, and then we will have all those who wish to testify on the whole package. That way we're kind of not separating them out by bills.
Right. Okay. So to the extent that people had indicated a desire to testify on 3163, we'll be testifying on this amendment to this bill, and again, we'll go in that order of having the proponents speak first and then the opponents. Any questions of Mr. Johnson? And Sam, do you have any other anybody else to testify on the bill?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Carolyn Jackson, as well as Professor Olivia Pound, would like to speak in support of other aspects of the A4 amendment. So if there are no further questions for Mr. Johnson on either the traveling data or the cybers bill, I will call the other to testify. So, Mr.
Okay, let's bring them forward. Okay, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Carolyn Jackson. I'm the lobbying coordinator for the ACLU of Minnesota, and I'm here to talk about gang databases. The ACLU of Minnesota is a nonpartisan organization with over 11,000 members statewide. We have concerns about due process with and gang databases. When the government gathers data about a person, due process demands that the subject of the data have the opportunity to review and correct that data. However, with criminal investigative data, the data is confidential or non-public so as not to jeopardize a criminal investigation, and the subject of the data is not allowed to know the nature of the data held by the police. Inactive files held by police lay in the gray zone between these two interests. If you were imprisoned, you have the right to a writ of habeas corpus, which means you could file a suit questioning whether you were imprisoned under due process of law. If you were prosecuted, you would have the right to know the nature of the charges against you and who was accusing you. Having your name on a gang database means you are automatically a suspect when a crime is committed. Having your name in the file means you will be stopped and questioned by the police, arrested. These are encroachments on your liberty, but they don't rise to the level if you were arrested and imprisoned. The impact of the gang databases goes beyond a single incident. Identification as a potential gang member subjects a person to over-policing. The privacy of the databases can allow improper racial profiling to occur without review. Furthermore, reliance on databases without individualized suspicion can misdirect investigations and waste precious resources. Finally, the ill will created in the community by concerns, real or perceived, about these databases inhibits community cooperation with police officers. Due process exists to empower individual challenges to errors in data. The collateral consequences of over-policing and racial profiling should raise concerns about the cost of gang databases. The ACLU of Minnesota encourages the legislature to adopt this language that's in the bill to abolish the GangNet-type databases and to encourage law enforcement to focus on individualized suspicion.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Any questions of the witness? Parents to be none, sir.
Professor Levy-Pound.
Good afternoon. I'm Nakima Levy-Pounds. I'm a law professor from the University of St. Thomas School of Law, and with me is...
My name is Hugo Chen, and I'm a law student at University of St. Thomas School of Law.
Please proceed.
Thank you. We are here today to talk about research that we conducted related to the Minnesota Gang Pointer File and GangNet databases. Excuse me. We were contacted last summer by the St. Paul NAACP about concerns related to the use of gang databases in Minnesota. And we set out to find out more information about how the gang databases were operating and some of the impacts on community members. One of the things that we found was that there are two gang databases that collectively hold nearly 20,000 people's names and data in them. And that's the Gang Pointer File, which had 2,438 alleged gang members in it, which is authorized by the Minnesota legislature to be in existence, as well as GangNet, which had 16,764 alleged gang members. One of the things that was surprising to us was the fact that people of color were severely overrepresented in the gang databases. For example, African Americans were 54% of those listed in the Gang Pointer File, while being only 4.6% of the population of Minnesota. And with regard to GangNet, African Americans were 42.4% of those listed in GangNet, or 7,108. And so we found the overrepresentation of people of color to be quite disturbing. When you look at GangNet, one of the reasons that we believe that people of color are overrepresented in this particular database is because the threshold for entry is so low. The Gang and Drug Oversight Council established 10-point criteria that would be in use to determine alleged gang members. Under the Minnesota Gang Pointer File, a person would have to meet 3 of the 10 criteria, plus be at least 14 years of age and convicted of a gross misdemeanor or a felony. However, when you look at the standards for GangNet, a person need only meet 1 of the 10-point criteria and need not commit any crime for entry into the GangNet database. Additionally, GangNet doesn't seem to have any standards that it is operating by under the Minnesota legislature, unlike the Gang Pointer File. And so, the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office has their own created authority, it seems, to administer GangNet and to determine who gets into GangNet and who gets out of GangNet. And so that's a huge concern, given the large number of citizens whose data was entered into the GangNet system. And so as we conducted our research, we met with members of the community. We looked at law review articles so that we could see this from a scholarly perspective. We also looked at different statutes and other information that would help us to discern how these gang databases are being used in the Twin Cities and what the overarching issues are that are cause for concern. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Hugo, who's going to talk a little bit about some of the concerns.
I believe we had some testimony on this previously, so it's not necessary to repeat it again. We already heard a presentation once, but go ahead, Mr. Chad.
The community voiced a lot of concerns, but among all the concerns, there are 3 main ones that we would like to address today. The first one being the difficulty in verifying whether one's data is included in a gang database. Currently, the data is classified as criminal investigative data, so it is confidential data. So it is close to impossible for a community member or member of the public to verify whether he or she is on the database or not. Secondly, there is a lack of knowledge regarding one might contest the data. It is very hard and very unclear on what type of mechanism there is to empower a member of the community to contest incorrect data when they're included in the database. And thirdly, it is unclear who has access to the database, so we do not know the full range of the collateral consequences. And there are different examples of collateral consequences in terms of job consequences or increased police contest and brutality. But then these are just two of the examples that we have.
And just to conclude, in the report that we drafted, which was disseminated to the public in December 2009, one of the major questions that we raise is whether or not GangNet should remain in existence for a number of the reasons that we listed in the report and things that have been testified here today. And based upon our research, we believe that given the overrepresentation of people of color in the gang databases, the low threshold for entry into the GangNet database, the lack of parental notification, the lack of information given to citizens about how to get into a gang, how they get in and how they get out of a gang database, calls for repeal of gang pornophile and GangNet databases.
Thank you. Any questions of the witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I raised this question before when we had previous testimony, and we've had a lot of talk about minorities being overly represented in prison populations, and now we're talking about overrepresentation of names of minorities on lists of people that would be found in some of these task forces. And the question that has yet to be answered is, what is the cause of that overrepresentation? If you look at the criminal justice system, and if you were starting at the end of the process, the prison population, then you'd move down or back earlier in this timeline, and you'd go to a prosecution or a conviction, then a prosecution. With the prosecution comes a defense, and then the arrest is prior to that. And then prior to the arrest is a probable cause based on the behavior of an individual. So where do we get the overrepresentation? Are we really trying to say that there's a racist attitude in Minnesota society and that that's the cause of this overrepresentation? Or is it the concentration of these task forces that have been in urban communities? And that might explain some of it just by the demographics of it all? Or could we go all the way back to the activities of the alleged perpetrators triggering a probable cause and then an arrest? And I don't think we've had that discussion, but we've had this public policy conversation over a couple different issues before the legislature. And we get the aspersions, but we don't get the real conclusion. Is anyone willing to give a conclusion on this? Because I'm trying to figure out what we're really trying to say in public here.
Professor Levy Pounds? Or Senator Moore?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I absolutely agree with you that the issue is not necessarily isolated to one set of actors in our system, but it's a systemic issue that begins at first contact. It may depend on geography. It may depend on the time of the day. It may depend on the time of the year. And then it goes all the way through from first contact with law enforcement to perhaps the decision on who gets detained and who gets arrested, to who ultimately gets charged and charged for what, to who ultimately ends up, you know, in front of a judge, to who ultimately ends up being sentenced, who ultimately ends up being incarcerated. And depending on resources and the type of alternatives that are in existence, it goes all the way to who ultimately gets released, who gets put on probation, who gets put on supervision, and who gets reconnected to our community. So I'm in agreement with you that it's not productive – sufficient for us to merely, and I'm not saying that that's what Professor Levy Pound is doing, but I want to use your words to say, you know, to pretend to cast aspersions on maybe one particular segment of our criminal justice system and then feel somehow like we've done our job when I think it's a systemic issue. And I think that one of the things you've noticed as a pattern in this committee is that the question we keep coming back to is to say, let's step back. It's not about one particular set of actors, but it's really looking at the pipeline. Because the fact of the matter is that if we are stay true to isolation, if our law enforcement officers do everything that they can to arrest everybody that who have bad behavior, and if our prosecutors do an excellent job of prosecuting everybody who comes to them, and if everybody gets 100% in whatever it is that they do, then we will have overcrowded prisons and we will never have the opportunity to have this discussion. And so I absolutely agree with you, and I don't intend for... I don't take the professor's testimony here to isolate a particular group of actors. I think she's speaking to, though, a phenomenon that is evident in these two databases. The reason why I'm repealing the two databases is not solely because of the disproportionate representation of people of color in the databases. It's because we've looked at whether or not these databases have law enforcement utility. And I think we've heard from Superintendent O'Malley that... from his perspective, with all due respect to our local law enforcement people, that we're moving in the direction, if we are looking at cybers and looking at other ways that we can do better law enforcement, that maybe the gang pointed file system and gang net type databases doesn't have as high of a utility as that compared to other types of databases that are incident based that are more helpful. So the reason why I'm repealing it is not solely because of this, although it is one component of it. It is really the utility piece of it that was persuasive to me.
Any other questions of the witnesses?
Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah Moore. Did you have any other witnesses on your bill?
I believe there are a number of people who would like to speak to against different pieces or comment right on different pieces of the bill, so I will move aside and have them come up.
What I'd like to do is to set aside for the moment the law enforcement data from other states. I know there's some people here who are hearing that. So if you've got some concerns about the rest of the bill, let's hear that first. Then we will hear the law enforcement data from other states. So any concerns on the rest of the bill other than that one issue? If you could come forward and please identify yourself for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. I'd like to speak to both parts of the bill, and I think you can appreciate, I saw the amendment here, the A4 amendment, just a few moments ago. And so while I will attempt to comment on it, it's difficult to do so quickly. First of all, I want to thank Senator Moi, thank the committee members. What's clear in the bill, with the desire to have prosecutors be a part of the oversight, is certainly a recognition that we do play an important role in the process, and we welcome that. If we were to make some technical suggestions, it really has to do with the fact that some of the language here, and I'm looking particularly at lines 6.2, 6.4, 6.6 of the original bill, where it talks about the prosecutor's duty on that oversight council.
Yes.
It talks about prosecutors shall ensure that. And anytime you're telling somebody to ensure that, you're implying that they have the power to do something about it if they can't ensure that. And that's a struggle here, because as prosecutors, our proper role is to advise. It is to suggest to the person who should have ultimate authority as to what's going on. We are not in the position to supervise law enforcement, to direct law enforcement officers as to how they should do their jobs. And so I'd simply encourage, as we work through this language, to maybe remove the words ensure training and perhaps shall be responsible for recommending the nature and frequency of training that law enforcement should review. Another example is ensure seizures and forfeitures. That's really not our proper role, but it certainly is to advise on the proper policies for how those should be carried out. So that's more of a technical. I know you want the involvement of prosecutors, but we really have to be careful that we're not put in a position to supervise law enforcement because we don't view that as our proper role. In terms of in Section 8 of the original bill, the dissolving the strike force, that's more of a technical question to you as we work through it. I know there's a desire to wrap up the Minnesota Gang Strike Force and to get this over with. The difficulty comes that this was created as a joint powers agreement, and they took on things like leases and insurance policies that are currently being used to pay claims to people who allege there was misconduct. And I would be very concerned if in the legislature dissolving that, you also dissolve the insurance policy that backs that up and dissolve some of those responsibilities. So I simply ask that we continue the discussion on that and think carefully before the legislature actually moves in to dissolve something that by all appearances appears to be wrapping itself up in an orderly fashion. I know there's a desire to get rid of it, but let's make sure we don't do that in a way that's going to harm maybe some existing insurance policies.
Mr. Brown, going back to your first point on page 6,
yes.
6.1, it says the prosecutor on the governing board shall. This question for you and possibly Senator Moore. If it just said the governing board shall have the following responsibilities, does that get to your issue? Page 6.1.
So if you were to simply say it as the governing board shall?
The board shall have the following responsibilities.
Sure. Yes.
Okay.
I think that would be a fairly straightforward solution.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lerber.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moi, I notice we're talking about the governing board, but now, if I understand it, you have two panels. You have the governing board and you have the oversight council. And I know in your introductory comments, at least I didn't hear the interaction of these two. How do they relate to one another, and why do we have two now rather than one?
Sir Moore.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lerner, you may recall that we've always had two. We had a statewide oversight council that had responsibilities for the broader governance of these smaller, multi-jurisdictional or single-jurisdictional task forces all over the state. And so those duties and responsibilities are spelled out in the first half of the bill with respect to the duties and responsibilities of the Oversight Council. Then each task forces have their own governing board that governs the work of that task force. And it is on this local governing task force board that we are asking for the participation of the prosecutors. And so this language about the role of the prosecutors is in the context of having prosecutors be part of the governance structure of the local governing board that governs the work of the local task forces. And Mr. Chair, I just want the record to reflect that I know everyone is really busy, and Mr. Brown said that he had just seen the A4 amendment. It's true. We just passed out the A4 amendment. But the language with respect to the prosecutors and the changes with respect to issue on resolving the council are part and parcel of the bill as introduced. And so I don't have a problem working with Mr. Brown or others on reviving this language to address some of their concerns. But it's hard for me to do that at the table when the language has been out for a while. It is not my intent that just because we resolve the Gang and Drug Oversight Council that we resolve all the tails obligations that come with the existence of that council. And I'm going to ask Ms. Pontius, but I thought, or Mr. Backus, I thought there was, and I couldn't find it, I thought there was language in here to do that. And if there isn't, it's my intention to make sure that we put language in here that speaks to that effect.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what you might be talking about is on line 10.30, where it says all current and future obligations and liabilities of the joint powers entity remain with the parties to the agreement and do not transfer to the state. I think that, Madam, this is on line on page 10, line 30.
Mr. Chair, that is the language that I had was directed towards. It's talking about it. They remain with the parties to the agreement, but not with that joint powers entity. And because it's the joint powers entity that's insured, that's where our concern comes from.
Samuel?
Mr. Chair, then I suggest that we just change a couple of words in that sentence because I thought that that took care of the issue. So if there's a clearer, better way to amend the language to reflect what Mr. Brown is talking about, I'm more than open to that.
Well, I don't know if we've got the language here at the moment. Did you want to look at, if we could back up to 6.1, do you have any thoughts on saying the governing board shall have the responsibility as opposed to the prosecutor of the governing board?
Mr. Chair, we specifically put prosecutors on the governing board for the very specific purpose of their expertise. And so it may be a matter of comfort to take out the prosecutor, but I think that our expectation is that with their expertise, they will advise the governing board on those responsibilities. I guess, you know, I would be open to the will of the committee, although the intent is clear here, that that's what makes the participation of the prosecutor on the governing board meaningful.
Mr. Chairman.
Sir Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, we talked about, I think, originally that we would just refer to the governing board, but I, too, think it should be the prosecutor because you want – I understand that's why you want them on the governing board. What did you describe how this was handled or how this has been handled before this in terms of requirements for training?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, we didn't have prosecutors on the governing board, and we didn't have prosecutors as part of the governing structure to develop these types of policies and procedures. So it varied, I believe, from jurisdiction to jurisdiction as to the depth and the breadth of prosecutorial participation in the work of the task forces. And so this was one of the points that I believe the our legislative auditors, as well as the Lugar report, pointed to, is that we need to bring in prosecutorial participation.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir Shad.
Mr. Chairman, so I know I do agree with that, but I wonder, I think on line 6.2, I understand the concern of Mr. Brown about the word ensure. I think you might just say provide.
Oversee.
And, or oversee, a little voice to my right just suggested. And the word adequate is so, I think it's subjective. And so, I mean, I would say, what was that again?
Oversee
training for officers assigned. But I also understand at some point the governing board, it seems to me, is going to then be responsible for the adequacy of that and the appropriateness of that training. So, but I think it is important that it, what you're getting at is that you have the prosecutor in this position and on this board for the very specific purpose of seeing that people comply with processes or procedures to have successful prosecutions. I mean, that's what this is about. So
okay.
I would just like to know how Senator Moy feels about if
Mr. Chair, I'm fine with that. If Senator Scheid would like to make that amendment.
Senator Scheid?
Mr. Chairman, then I'd move on line 6.2 to strike ensure adequate and insert oversee.
Okay.
That's about 6.6.
And then I wonder about 6.6, but maybe we can deal with that after this.
Okay, Sarah Scheid moves on page 6.2
delete the words ensure adequate and insert oversee. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Then, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like. Was Mr. Brown also referencing the insure on 6.6?
He did mention
Mr.
that.
Mr. Chair, yeah.
Oh, so I think that there we wouldn't be overseeing. I don't know if that's a. I mean, somebody has to be responsible for that reporting. That's pretty fundamental to where we're trying to get. I'm going to defer to the person on my right for a word.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, if being responsible for making sure that seizures and forfeitures are reported, then ensure is the right word.
Okay.
As an English major.
There we go. Thank
my
you.
Humble opinion.
Same way. I think you're right.
I think the commissioner is on the case.
Anything further?
Madam Vice
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I look back in the 60s and 70s,
could you
federal speak in government
mic?
provided us with funds for alcohol enforcement. And as a part of that, why there was a grant from them giving authority to the member as a county attorney's office, and I think also the attorney general's office, and they were using that for actual prosecution. So to have some prosecutor be an employee of or within this group isn't anything new. And I think that even now that the attorney general's office does a fair amount of prosecution in certain areas, especially for rural people that have less access to the prosecution there.
Okay. Anything further on this issue?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Moore, if I could direct you to page 6, lines 25 and 26. This is discussion of a required report to go to the chairs of the Senate and the House of Representative Committees. And I would like to make reference to including the ranking minority members of those respective committees. I don't think there's a reference in this provision.
This is current law, but Senator Limmer moves on page 6.26 after the word chairs, add the words and the ranking minority members. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Anything further on this issue?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, if I could turn you back to the Drug Oversight Council. I noticed that on lines 227 through 32, you're doing a little streamlining in this council. Previously, there were members of the legislature that were members, and why are we taking the legislative members, only two from each house or each chamber, why are we taking those out of this council?
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, we thought that, I felt that it was important to take the legislative members out so that the members of the legislature are not put in a conflicted position when they, on the one hand, has an obligation and a fiduciary duty to participate as a member of this oversight council. But if the oversight council messes up, then the legislator has to then participate in having some oversight over the oversight council. And so I thought it makes it clearer and cleaner if we took the legislative members out of the oversight council so that we don't put them in a conflicted position when it comes to having legislative oversight over the council.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
I know, Senator Moore, that we have legislators on a lot of councils and commissions throughout the state of Minnesota. Are they also in a potential conflict of interest? And I'm not sure if fiduciary responsibility is the real duty that a legislator serves on an advisory committee. Usually a fiduciary responsibility reflects the representation to a client and making sure that their wishes are enacted in a dispute or a contract or some type of representation. But I'm just, you know, we can do what we want, but I guess I'm just questioning, of all the legislators that are members of commissions and councils throughout the state of Minnesota, I'm not sure if that's necessarily a conflict of interest where to give it oversight. And maybe if there was more involvement by legislators on some of these commissions, sometimes we take almost a cavalier attitude on the membership that we sometimes hold on these, and that if we would be a little more participatory, maybe this mess wouldn't have started in the first place.
I don't know if that's a question or not, but Mr. Brown, I don't know. Think we've got any resolution to the other issues, so I'm going to see if there's anybody else who's here on the bill. Mr. Brown?
Senator, Mr. Chair, I have one other issue, and it has to do with the data.
Okay.
That is the second piece. I believe it is addressed in the A4 amendment. In the A4 amendment, it eliminates the gang database systems, both the pointer file and the GangNet type systems. In the prior version of the bill, it essentially turned GangNet into a version of the pointer file, and that we do have significant concerns with, and I believe a proposed, if not solution, a way to look at this. I know there's been testimony before on the distinction between the pointer file, which is really a law enforcement tool to identify gang members because they've met three criteria and have a prior criminal conviction, gross misdemeanor or felony. GangNet is really just a different way of saying an investigative system. It doesn't necessarily organize itself by people, but rather by data collected. And that is how we both solve crimes and prosecute crimes that are committed for the benefit of a gang. And if those databases are eliminated, in Minneapolis, we still use GangNet to the extent we search it, but we put our data into something else called STS. To eliminate those is to incredibly restrict our ability to not only solve crimes, but to prosecute crimes for the benefit of a gang. Let me give you an example. We had one of our prosecutors recently successfully prosecute a murder that was committed in 2001. It wasn't solved till 2006, and it wasn't tried until 2009. In 1999, the individual accused of the crime had been stopped and was wearing gang clothing and admitted being a member of this particular gang that was being prosecuted. In 2001, he again admitted that he had been accused of that, or that he was a member of that gang. In 2009, when we went to prosecute that case, we were able, using that database, to go back and find those prior incidents, because that's what led us to the evidence. You don't use the fact that somebody's in that system as evidence in court. What that does is let you go find the officer that stopped him in 1999 and go find the officer that stopped them in 2001 and get them to come into court and testify. And that's how we prove something is done for the benefit of a gang. And so it is incredibly important that we be able to have access to that kind of data. With regard to how it is kept and how it is used, there are some legitimate concerns, and we have had some discussions. As many of you are aware, there is a similar proposal advancing in the other body where we've had a chance to discuss this with stakeholders. And many of the law enforcement agencies already comply with federal regulations about what kind of data can go into these systems, how it can be maintained, how it can be used. The specific code statute is 28 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 23. And that restricts how they do that, and they're already doing that. It talks about purging data after 5 years. if there's no new criminal involvement or imprisonment. It talks about what reasons you can't keep data for religious, racial, other kinds of profiling reasons. So there are some real restrictions in there that we think are the framework for a very good discussion about it. But the notion of either turning the local law enforcement databases into something like the pointer file, the problem, which was the original proposal, let me give you the problem. The pointer file requires three incidents. But these data systems are a series of single incidents. If you were to create a system that says, well, you can't keep data in a local database unless it meets the pointer file, you're never going to get to three incidents because you'll never get one incident. You have to have the three incidents, and you have to be able to keep them somewhere, and you have to be able to find them somewhere. And here's why it's so useful. Without something like GangNet or the ability to go look around and find out that the first incident happened in St. Cloud and the second one happened in Rochester, that means that the police or the prosecutors have to call each jurisdiction in the state of Minnesota to find that information out. Or if it's a tattoo that was found in a jail cell when they were booked in, we have to call each and every jail to find out was that there. And that's just not something that is feasible within, you know, the kinds of constraints we have. So we are certainly willing to engage in a discussion about how it is we can better limit how local law enforcement keeps this data, how local law enforcement uses this data. And those are all important discussions to have. But the notion of eliminating it is something that I think would not serve the citizens or the public safety of this community well.
Any questions at this point?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Brown's testimony points to exactly why we need to repeal GangNet and Game Pointer File. The language repealing the investigative databases does not in any way prohibit the collection or the maintenance of data relating to gang membership on an individual record basis at the local law enforcement jurisdiction in those geographic areas. So Ramsey County, Hennepin County, St. Paul Police Department, Minneapolis Police Department can continue to keep their investigative data files, their databases, exactly the way that Hennepin County and the city of Minneapolis are doing. We're just saying that they can't wholesale dump that stuff into a system like GangNet. And the fact of the matter is that GangNet was never in compliance with 28 CFR, the federal standard, until January 2010 when Professor Levy Pound's group came out with their report. And so, I think that local law enforcement can continue to do exactly what they're doing today without the unnecessary burden of the gang net and gang pointer file system.
Senator Orban.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Moore, and maybe Mr. Brown.
We'll move the mic up a little bit.
Can talk about this, but what if you have the instance where a crime is committed in Brooklyn Center and then one in Brooklyn Park and then one in Minneapolis by the same perpetrator? You couldn't track that with what Senator Ma, what you're saying should be the system. What you're saying is you can't put them together. Brooklyn Center can have its record, and Brooklyn Park can have its record, and Minneapolis can have its, but they can't share files. That's what you're saying. We can make phone calls, but they can't share the information that they are already lawfully allowed to maintain. And you're saying you can't talk to each other through the computer.
Mr. Chair,
Sir Moore.
While GangNet and Gang Pointer File doesn't allow you to do that right now. So whether GangNet or Gang Pointer File stays doesn't help you with that situation. But what we are trying to do with the cybers conversation and with moving towards a broader conversation about law enforcement's ability to use incident-based investigative data to track the signatures of crimes that happens throughout different parts of the state of Minnesota, that's where we want to get to with BCA and with the conversations about cybers and how we move forward. So that's why when I started this, I said the conversation here is, if that's where you want to go, Senator Ortman, Gang Pointifile and GangNet does not help you. That's where I want to get to, and that's the conversation that we ought to have. But Gang Pointifile and GangNet doesn't help you with that situation.
Sarah Orban.
Mr. Chair, then I don't understand the plain application then of Subdivision 30 in the A4 amendment.
Where's that? Where is it?
The A4 amendment lines 1.5 to 1.9.
1.29?
No, 1.5 to 1.9.
And the question is, Mr. Chair?
Sir Ortman?
Mr. Chair and Senator Moy, I'm trying to understand what you're trying to accomplish with this provision and what its application is to current practices for law enforcement.
Sir Moy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, it prohibits local law enforcement agencies from wholesalely dumping their investigative information into one database.
Sarah Olson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moy, I thought you said that this was not the bill was not going to affect the way that local gang strike force organizations were storing and maintaining data. And if this prohibits them from doing that, how is that? How does that statement not contradict the language that's in the bill?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, your local violent crimes task force in your area will continue to do the work that they're doing, continue to do the investigation work that they're doing. I don't even know if your local law enforcement agencies dump their gang information into the gang net system that's currently being maintained by the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. So if your local law enforcement agency is doing that, then this would affect them, that they can't dump it anymore. But that doesn't mean that they can't maintain that information for their own investigative purposes.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Senator Moy, this says a law enforcement agency. It does not limit it to St. Paul or any particular area. Says must not administer or maintain a computerized criminal gang investigative data system. It doesn't specifically limit that to any particular type of system. It just says they basically can't store this information on the computer is what it sounds like to me. That seems pretty broad. That seems pretty broad in terms of the limitation.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, the intent here is to prohibit the gang net type databases from being created. And that's why we have the second sentence that says it does not prohibit the collection or maintenance of data relating to gang membership on an individual record basis so that the local law enforcement agencies can continue to do what they are currently doing.
Any further discussion? Anything else, Mr. Brown?
Just briefly, Mr. Chair. As we talk about this, what I implore you to consider is not to go back to silos of information. That is, Minneapolis knows what Minneapolis knows, and St. Paul knows what St. Paul knows, and Duluth knows what Duluth knows. Gangs don't recognize those geographic distinctions, and law enforcement officers attempting to solve crimes can't call each jurisdiction to do that. So while I appreciate the desire not to dump information, what we need to do is be thoughtful about who it is that's keeping it, who's responsible for keeping it at each of those agencies, and that all of those agencies abide by the same kinds of restrictions on how they can disseminate it, how they can use it. Those are all legitimate concerns and legitimate limitations. But to go back to note cards and limitations on how officers can share information would really be a step backwards in our ability to solve crimes. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. We have two other people who wanted to testify on the bill, and as I say, after, then we're next we'll talk about law enforcement data from other states. Would Richard Neumeister and Jim Franklin wish to testify on the bill?
What's that noise?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. Let's start out at the A4 amendment on page three, lines 13 through 14. I believe, at least by talking with law enforcement about this issue over a number of years, and secondly, just recently with one law enforcement officer here, it's basically for GPS location data, which is generally what was being talked about. You basically need a Fourth Amendment probable cause standard rather than a court order. And there's a distinction, particularly in the 626A, which this is applied to. So I think it's a good attempt, and I don't know, but I want to make sure that if the practice is basically a probable cause search warrant and a Fourth Amendment basis, that's what it should be. Secondly, by doing a review of RNC data here in Ramsey County in terms of the number of search warrants that was done, it was for cell phone records or locations, it was basically Fourth Amendment type of a search warrant rather than a court order, which is different. Thirdly, nationally, a number of states and in court cases are starting to say that there is a strong privacy interest in when government wants to do surveillance on you and are basically saying the probable cause standard. So I just want to share that as part of a clarification as the bill moves forward. And I suggest if you find in the research and as things goes on that you deal with that probable cause standard rather than a court order. Now, one of the things that I would like to talk about now is on page 1, basically subdivision 30. As someone who's been around a long time and as Superintendent O'Malley has publicly said, I'm applying the ointment or something to that effect with law enforcement. I'm very well familiar with databases, how information is gathered, and also, as you may know, I've served on the CRIMNET Committee or the Criminal Justice Information Task Force since its inception. One of the things that I have concerns about is that you call it computerized criminal gang investigative data. You outlaw that, you do whatever. Folks will just put another name on it. They'll call it the Violent Offender Investigative Database or whatever. Now, law enforcement, what happens where I've seen you take something away, they'll come up with another way of doing something. So one of the things that has happened nationwide, and even to say to some extent I will say here in Minnesota, is that what will happen, you get rid of a database, they'll just show up somewhere else. It could be through a private entity with such things called like COPLINK or the well-known MJNO, which was found illegally to be done in 2003 and 2004. So one of the things that, you know, you take something away, where may it show up later? You've got to remember that this bill, one of the things that was described in testimony, Representative Paymar, law enforcement, and parties who have an interest in this bill on the other side had 5 hours of discussion between the two of them with Representative Paymar representing that perspective.
That's not relevant here, Mr. Neumeister. Please proceed.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, one of the things that came up in some of that testimony that discussion was how Minneapolis and other entities, because I was there, it was part of the meeting, have their own databases. So the point is we don't know what's out there and the kinds of databases that they have. Thirdly, reference was given to 28 CFR 23, which has a very low threshold standard of how people can get into a database or a system. Other states like Texas, Oregon, Iowa, a number of other municipalities have some higher standards and higher standards of accountability and transparency. So I think that's important to be aware of. One of the things that was mentioned here is what is STS that Senator County Attorney Brown talked about in terms of databases. And one of the other things that on page 18.19, where the discussion is, relating to gang membership on the individual record basis, what will that criteria be? Will that be the criteria that will be developed in the major part of the bill where community people and this new oversight will try to have come up with a kind of a new criteria? And the bottom line is the thing, and Senator Moore, Chairperson Moore, is correct on this. A lot of people are looking at cybers and other kinds of now current systems to do some of the things in a more wider dissemination of data. Whether or not cybers will be a subset of intelligence data, whether it be a subset of labeled suspect or gang or drug offender or whatever, those are questions that are still out there and need to be addressed. Even recently, as of last year, because with cybers, where $1 million has been spent, was the replacement of NJNO, there was even discussion of getting rid of some of the high standards that we now have for cybers. So I'm just sharing with you a perspective on some of these things, and that if you're going to do some of these things, there needs to be a fair amount of discussion. And on another item, which is separate than what I, you know, the traveling data, I will talk more about that because they're all interrelated.
We'll talk about that later. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, yeah. Members of the committee, those are my points of view.
Any questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I want to share with Senator Moore that, I mean, I have concern about the silos and having information at random and not being able to, somebody not being able to connect the dots. Is the issue more of the standard for how somebody gets into the system than it is about being there? In other words, what gets somebody into this may be standing around with a couple of other people wearing certain color clothing, and suddenly, I don't know if that gets marked as an incident, if that gets you into that system versus somebody who's, you know, I think it's important for there to be patterns be able to be established.
Sir Moore.
If you look at the other part of the A5 Amendment, there's a section on A4. Cybers, on the A4 Amendment. There's a section on cybers. Okay. And I have a sheet here that's in front of you for you to look at that talks about cybers. And the second half of my sentence, which I didn't complete, it completed in my mind, but I didn't say when I was responding to Senator Ortman, was that cybers is what's going to be helpful in the situation that you're talking about. Because we have paid for a state system that's incident-based, available to local law enforcement agencies for local law enforcement purposes to be able to upload exactly the type of incidences that you're talking about into this system so that our law enforcement agents can go in and for law enforcement purposes use this database to do the kind of work that you're talking about. So the second piece of the A4 amendment that talked about cybers, we allow law enforcement to share incident databases data exactly as you've mentioned for them to do their work. And so the cybers, the section 4 of the amendment, we're asking for expansion of law enforcement being able to use that database for these additional services. But what the current law says is that cybers already exist. So earlier when I say that it's an issue of weighing the utility of GangNet type and GangPointer file type against a system like cybers that we've already paid for, it's created, it's existent, and it works for cross-agency conversations and incidences, that's why when you weigh at the utility of the game pointer file and GangNet, given all the other stuff that comes with it, has very low utility, whereas cybers is what's important for law enforcement. It's the direction that we're moving in.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moore, I'm hoping that somebody will comment today about how far along cybers is in its development. Is it useful to local law enforcement? Do they have their own databases? And what does that mean practically if we focus just on cybers going forward?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, CBRS is in existence at the present time. It has 102 law enforcement agencies contributing incident data. It has 107 that are eligible to extract inquiries from it. We have state funding that's available in the integration money appropriated by the legislature to continue building adapters that transfer data from local law enforcement agencies' records management system into the CBRS system. It operates over the Secure Criminal Justice Network, the CJDN, the Criminal Justice Data Network, and it is regulated by legislative action under Minnesota Statute 299C40. At the present time, it has approximately 250,000 records in it. We just brought the Ramsey County Sheriff's Department, signed an agreement with them, and we're in the final stages of negotiating with the Minneapolis Police Department to have incident data transferred over to them. So it is an existing system. Minimum contribution is 6 fields of data. Maximum is 126 fields of data. And one of those fields, I need to tell you, is not a box that says somebody is or is not a member of a gang. It has incident data, it has person data, it has vehicle data, it has physical descriptor data, and does not have incident narratives, but then provides a methodology to identify where those records exist and what law enforcement agency and where to go to get further information.
Sarah Olson.
thank you, Mr. Chair. And now we've kind of morphed into discussing something that I think we were going to discuss separately. But as long as it's really not possible to talk about one without also talking about the other.
Well, I'd rather not talk about the traveling data if we can. You know, I mean, because if we open that door, I mean, I want to get the rest of the bill done first, and then we'll go to the traveling data.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think I'm talking particularly just about that, except to the extent that if we're going to be talking about CBRS and how it's being used to address dealing with the gang and drug store data, then I think I just want to say that I think there are some concerns about getting into a whole new classification of data and how we're dealing with it, that we've been, you know, talking about having a broader discussion on that publicly for a long time, and it just makes me concerned about going partway down that road without having had that discussion.
Any other questions on – is there anybody else who wants to be heard on the bill? Sarah Higgins, do you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I have a couple of questions on the makeup of the new Oversight Council. If we could move to that, it's not terribly exciting compared to what we've been talking about. There is
Where are you at?
Pages 2 and 3.
Okay.
And it talks about who's going to be on the new council, and I see, Senator Moy, that you're deleting all of the federal representation from that. You're also deleting the legislative members, and I'm actually the person who's on this, and I haven't been to very many of the meetings, but my committee administrator has been to most of them, and she has brought back good information from those meetings that I think has been useful to us. We're not voting members of the organization, but I think that we should think about whether we really want to cut off our entree into the group. And I think also that the representatives from the federal agencies bring good data. They have good insights that I think help the organization as well. And the third item I wanted to ask about was on 319 and 320, where you eliminate the duty to make funding recommendations to the commissioner about the grants. And I'm wondering who you were thinking of who might be making those recommendations to OJP and the commissioner.
Yeah, now Senator Limmer had actually previously raised a question about the elimination of
–
right, you weren't here, but he had a question about the elimination of the legislators.
Right.
But Senator Moy, did you have a response about the issues?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, it was, hey, you know what, if legislators want to put themselves on –
the stuff and do more work. I mean, it was my way of trying to manage the number of people on the Oversight Council. And so we could certainly have a discussion. I think that 32 people or whatever the number, I think it was 32 was just too much. Trying to get down to 15 and accommodate the different composition or smaller, and couldn't go any smaller. I mean, had to be at 15. So I think it's, you know, at the will of the different committees. This is going to the state and local government oversight committee, and they might have a different idea on what that composition should look like. So I'm open to input. My only criteria is help me manage the number. My intent here is to make the number, you know, manageable. And so if it's a desire to put legislators on there and to put federal people on there, the number would just get large. The other thing is, Senator Higgins, I was just worried about legislators and time commitment and their ability to sit on these task forces and council. And for this one, since it's my prerogative, I just took you all off of it. So if you all want to go back on it, so be it. But I just sense that. And I did mention to Senator Limmer that it's a conflict, it's a potential conflict issue. That when the outbreak of the Metro Gang Strike Force broke out, and it was our responsibility to go after the advisory council to say, what happened about you monitoring this particular task force? I think it would put the legislators on that council in a difficult position, because you're supposed to be responsible as part of this advisory group to monitor the task force. And so then how would that feel if you now have to sit on the legislative committee that is supposed to give oversight to the advisory council, that's supposed to have oversight over the task forces? So that was the rationale behind why I took the legislators off the council.
And about the third issue about the funding recommendations on page 3, line 19 and 20?
Just renumber, replace the information somewhere else. But I may be wrong. So let me take a look at that, and I can talk to you about it. If it's not in there and you want to make that change, okay, I'm open to it.
Okay, we have two more witnesses at the table. I would like to get through this bill at some point. Please welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Franklin, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, Minnesota Police Chiefs Association. Also with me today is Inspector Martin from Minneapolis Police Department. I will attempt to be as brief as possible and just simply say that as we've looked at this from a law enforcement perspective, it's quite apparent that we have a number of concerns, a number of things that we would disagree with the good senator on, and the interpretation of some of the things that have come out here today. I'd like to point out one thing that Ms. Jackson said in her testimony is that we focus on a subject and go after that person and immediately identify them. I want this committee to know that the purpose of a law enforcement agency is to get the facts, to find the guilty party, and for those who are not guilty to prove their innocence. The sword cuts both ways. And for us, that's a very important principle to keep in operation. The second point that I want to try to hit on is simply this. When the legislature created the ability for law enforcement to gain intelligence data on gangs back 15-plus years ago, when Minneapolis was called Murderopolis, we had a carved-out exception for law enforcement to gather this type of data, put it into the pointer system, which required 3 of 10 criteria, and it required a gross misdemeanor or a felony conviction of someone to be in that database. And how do we count to 3 to get them into the database today becomes the focus of this discussion. Through a grant that was put together and by and for Ramsey County, the money came from the DPS, we put together GangNet to collect that data. And if there's 2 things that are obvious over a period of time, number 1, the educational system of the data entry, and number 2, the ability of the legislature to fund and keep that system current and up to date with the current technologies has failed, and we need to improve that. I would also like to add that as we look at this bill, there is one glaring concern in the makeup of the committee, and that simply is that we have a representative from the Minneapolis-St. Paul-Hennepin-Ramsey County metro area in terms of police chiefs and sheriffs. When we look at Minneapolis-St. Paul-Hennepin-Ramsey County, they have probably in excess of 60% of the violent crime with gangs in that quadrant, but yet as we look at the how we make up the council, they're grossly underrepresented, and that's a concern. I want to point out that when Ms. Levy-Pounds brought the survey of St. Thomas, we, the Sheriff's Association, grasped upon this, and I think within about 2 or 3 days, invited her to come to our conference to sit down and take a look so that we could understand the survey, the study, and the information in it. While we may disagree with a few things that are there, and I won't go into them, I will simply say that it was a study that we sat back and said, you know, it's been 15, 16 years since anybody's looked at this. We need to relook at this. Sheriff Fletcher, who was running the gang net, had established criteria for that period of time, which was not in compliance with 28 CFR 23. And looking at that, we said, those are one of the things that we should probably do is bring that criteria that was applied 15, 18 years ago to today's, bring it to focus. Sheriff Fletcher has done that. We also looked at how many names are in there. There's over 6,000 names that were taken out of that database. The report said we should set up a juvenile notification system. We thought that was a great idea. We've done that. We think that there are some things there, and we have been meeting and discussing, and I thought had a very good dialogue until I hear some of where we're going here today, and now I have concern. As we move forward, one of the things that we have to talk about that has not been dropped on the table here today is we talk about investigative data. We're not talking about the white elephant in the room called intelligence data, because we have no classification for intelligence in Minnesota. And that's a major issue as we look at how we determine this. And I, with all due respect to the good senator, I certainly have to disagree with how we're going to maintain databases in the future under the current proposed bill. I would also simply say we have spent the last 15 years, and I can't begin to tell you how many millions of dollars we've dumped into CrimNet to try to talk to one another, and now we're going to break everything apart. I don't understand that logic at all. We're not addressing what the future technologies are. Technology is changing so fast, we are talking about something today without the insight of where we're going tomorrow. And perhaps a better approach is to sit down and put a work group together to say, how do we address the future needs? It's been discussed with cybers. That's a future, but we've got to figure out the pieces to make it work and come together. That's going to take some dialogue and not just a straight piece of legislation, in my mind, to do that. The other thing is that I would just simply say the databases are not the behavior that got the gang strike force in trouble. The gang strike force got in trouble because of their behavior, not because of the databases. And so I think as we look at the history of the pointer system, as we look at it, there's some really bad people in that pointer system that deserve to be there because of their criminal behavior. The pointer system was identified to notify law enforcement officers that if you trip upon this person, watch out. It's a safety-related issue. I would also say, with all due respect to Superintendent O'Malley, over 800 times in the last 65 days, that database has been queried, according to Ramsey County. I would say that's being used and not being used. It's probably not being used in the superintendent's office at BCA. It's probably not being used at the chief's office in Minneapolis and St. Paul. But I think that the line officers will tell you it's being used. It's not maybe being used to its fullest potential or the way it could because of my comments relative to training and education that have been lacking in this particular area. The bottom line of all of this is I think this is an extremely important topic. I think we have an extreme difference of opinion. I think we have an extreme difference of interpretation of language and understanding what the other person means. And so I think we're pledged to sit down, continue to work on these, but to try to get something drafted and in in a week or two, I think is a near impossibility due to the very complex subjects that we are dealing with here. With that, I'll close my comments.
Thank you. Any questions? Inspector Martin, did you have anything to say here?
Sarah Ortman. Mr. Franklin, can you comment about the makeup of the Oversight Council? And in particular, I know that most of the criminal activity surrounding gangs and drugs are in Ramsey County, Hennepin County, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. Can you comment on whether it might be a good idea to have permanent members from those communities on this council, given the number of task forces that operate in those areas?
Could you be brief?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ortman, the absolute answer is yes. Police chief from Minneapolis, police chief from St. Paul, sheriff from Hennepin, sheriff from Ramsey. That'll do it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Inspector Martin, did you have anything to add? Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, sir. Chairman, I will try to be as brief as possible. I'm inspector of the north side of Minneapolis. I oversee 130 officers who work the north side of Minneapolis. Prior to that, I was the commander of the Criminal Investigations Division for the Minneapolis Police Department and Special Operations Division, and oversaw our gang unit, narcotics unit, violent offender task force, the officers who were assigned to the gang strike force. Prior to that, I was the metro commander for the Minnesota Gang Strike Force in 2004 and 2005. I'm currently an instructor for the National Gang Center. I write curriculum for them, travel all over the country talking about how to run task forces, about intelligence databases, sharing information. One of the things that GangNet did when it was created, I was the supervisor of the gang unit in 1995 and 96 when we had our record homicides in Minneapolis. And our intelligence was very haphazard at that time. And we decided, each individual agency decided the criteria that we were going to use. We had a good system, I felt, in Minneapolis, but not everyone did. And GangNet brought some consistency to that. We had the 10 criteria that we used as indicators of gang involvement. Person had to be involved in criminal activity. And with all due respect to Ms. Levy Pounds, you did have to have, there had to be a criminal nexus or criminal activity there. And it gave us an opportunity to share information. We utilize that to this day. I was in GangNet yesterday looking up a gang member that was involved in some criminal activity in our city. And actually, I say I was looking up a gang member. I was looking up a man who I wasn't sure. And he wasn't a gang member. So that told me something, that he wasn't in there. There was no intelligence about him. Therefore, that was the issue in this particular incident. The requirement that all agencies adhere to the criteria that are established for the gang pointer file system is something that would very much tie our hands and our ability to deal with gang activity. The majority of the gang activity we see now is from hybrid gangs. The most violent stuff, smaller, younger, more violent gang members who are trying to make a name for themselves. And they don't escalate in their activity like they used to. We have 14, 15-year-old kids that are doing murder, and that's their first crime or their second crime that we're aware of. So it's more important than ever that we keep those individual instances documented, which gets to cyber. Cyber is a records management system, not an intelligence system. It is a system of police reports. This happened. Here's the evidence of that crime. This is what we're going to prosecute it for. You would never put in a police report that you pulled the brother aside and talked to him, and he admitted that they were gang members and that kind of intelligence. And that's the stuff that's not going to be in cyber that GangNet can provide for. Not GangNet, but a system like GangNet. GangNet software. It's not any worse than Word or Excel or PowerPoint or any other software. It's how you use that.
Could you kind of get to the point and wrap it up?
My final point I want to make is this is going to hurt the suburbs. In Minneapolis and St. Paul, we're the big kids on the block. We keep intelligence
data, investigative data on gangs. We know who the gang members are, but the Brooklyn Parks and the Brooklyn Centers and the Faribault's and the St. Clouds don't know who our bad guys are. They're the ones who benefited from GangNet. And if you saw a map of the hits and the queries, you'll see that these gang members were being queried all over the state. And they're the ones who are hurt.
Thank you. Any questions? Sarah Ortman.
Mr. Chair, Inspector, thank you for coming today. I have a question about cybers and its usefulness and application and whether you think that it's a mature enough tool to carry the weight for law enforcement.
Mr. Inspector Martin. Senator Ortman, I think at this point it's new and it's still being developed. I think right now it's just a matter of what's in there. I think that at some point it will be a useful tool related to records management and looking at official incidents of crime. I don't think that it's designed to operate at all as an intelligence database.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else who's here on the bill before we move to the next phase? Thank you. Come on forward. Before you start, Senator Moi, I think we need to get people here an idea of what the agenda is for the rest of the evening. I've noticed that some of the people who are here on the service animal bill have to leave now. I would hope we could get to that bill before a break, but clearly, you know, we're going to go late to the night. What should we tell the people about hanging around and so forth? Can we,
Mr. Chair? It was my hope that we would get to that bill. We began this bill because one of the testifiers had not arrived yet.
Right.
I'm more than willing to if we need to get them. I don't know if they've left or have just gone outside.
A number have been leaving, and you know, I'd like to accommodate them, but this is taking quite a while here.
Or I believe
is Senator
they're coming
DeBevel
back.
Around?
Mr. Chair, if they're willing to come back, I think that we certainly could set aside this conversation and take up that bill.
If Senator Dibble's around, if he could come on down here, maybe we could take a break here and get that bill out of the way. Yeah, can somebody call Senator Dibble's office? Okay, he's on his way down right now. So,
why don't we take the these testifiers and then this testifier?
Well, I'd like to get the author here first, so... Why don't we just wait a minute and see if he gets here?
Well, Mr. Chair,
can this be very brief? Okay, go ahead. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Grundorfer with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm here just to comment on Section 8 of the bill. That's the one that immediately dissolves the gang strike force. While nobody has any particular concern ultimately with the strike force going away, the problem with the bill as drafted is there are basically cars, cash, and claims that still have to be resolved as a result of the gang strike force activities. And if we simply abolish and dissolve the gang strike force without having a way to resolve those cash claims and car issues, we're going to frankly create a little bit of chaos for resolving those claims and those issues. So at the very least, we'd urge that the effective date on that section be pushed back a little bit so that we frankly have some time to get run out business of that entity. That's all I have.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, we're still trying to get Senator Dibble in here. Anybody else on the bill itself before we move on to something else?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Franken had referred to, and Ms. Neumeister and others had referred to, hours and hours and hours of conversations. I have not had the pleasure to participate in those conversations. So my bill is my bill. People have concern about it. The bill has been out. The postings for the committee, the bills that are on the amendment have been out, and I'm having some impatience with people who know better, who should come and talk to me so that we could fine-tune the language to reflect what they would like.
Okay. Let's temporarily set aside this bill. Senator Dibble, we have some people who have been here for quite a while on the service animal bill, Senate File 2990. Some people had to leave, and I'd like to accommodate them if I could. Senator Dibble, Center file service animal intentional harm resulting in inability to perform duties penalties. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 2990. Mr. Chair and members, what this bill attempts to address are those instances when service animals are attacked by someone. To add to the statute, right now the standard in the statute is that in order for a crime to be committed, it would needs to be found that the animal has received bodily harm. This would add to the statute to cause bodily harm to the animal or otherwise render the animal unable to perform its duties. And then, Mr. Chair and members, it defines that that's a gross misdemeanor, and it also provides for some restitution and civil remedies as a remedy provision. That's Section 3 on page 2, to provide for restitution for costs that relate to loss of income, veterinary expenses, transportation costs, and other expenses, et cetera. Mr. Chair and members, this stems from an incident that happened to one of my constituents, and she's here. She can come forward.
Okay, if she, yes.
Is Lolly? Mm-hmm. Oh, hi, Lolly. I didn't see you there. And Chris, we're going to come forward. All right. So, here, why don't you sit right here to your left, or to your right? I'm sorry. Chris, the chair right in front of you. Mr. Chair and members, we have Lolly Lajewski here, who can talk about her experience and Chris Bell, who's here from the National Federation.
Mayor and Council.
Excuse me.
Okay.
Sorry. I stand corrected.
Thank you. And Senator Dibble, could you assist him to make sure the microphones are in place?
Sure. Okay.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Lolly Lieski, and I'm from Minneapolis.
Go ahead.
Last September, I was walking into the Target store on 9th and Nicollet, and I was there to do some errands. As I entered the foyer, my dog's legs buckled. I reached down to see what happened. I had no idea for sure. I just thought something had happened. And at that point, a woman to my left said, "A woman just kicked your dog." It took me a while for the words to register because I would never have expected something like that to happen. And once those words did register, then I asked her again. She said she would help me find security. We went to do that and found someone. They checked the video, were able to locate the individual that had done it. She had not left the area at that point. She was still in the area. She still she was just outside the door. So they brought her in. Store security did. They called the Minneapolis police, who arrested her. But what the video showed was that she had kicked the dog in the jaw. And I can't tell you how I think until I heard that I was okay, but to really find that someone would do such a thing, would try to harm my dog in such a way when the dog had done nothing to her, was not in her way, was just going about its business, doing its job for me, was extremely upsetting. So the individual was charged. We pursued the charges, and she was, we went to court. She was found incompetent, basically. She was mentally ill, seriously mentally ill, and wasn't able to stand the charges. So they were dropped. But what happened as a result of my experience was people started to tell me, I'll back up 1 second, to say that my first, after the incident happened, my first concern was for my dog's physical well-being, and she seemed to be okay, but I did check her out at a vet's. The second was for emotional well-being, because these dogs are trained and they learn from birth to trust people. But one incident can change that into mistrust. And when you have a dog whose job it is to be amongst the public all the time, to be here, to be at a grocery store, to be in areas where there may be a lot of crowds and chaos, the animal needs to be stable, needs to be able to be able to handle a number of different situations. So that was my second concern. And I didn't know for sure how she was going to react when we went back to Target. Turned out, we went back about 4 days later. Her response was basically no response. And I was extremely grateful for that, because the training, the breeding, the work that goes into creating a service dog, but in particular a guide dog, is extremely, it's extremely thorough, and it's also very costly. A dog that does guide work at this point is the cost of a dog that is fully trained and that has been bred to do guide work is about $50,000. So any kind of retraining that might need to happen or replacement would be substantial, both in terms of the actual cost but also the amount of time and energy and emotional commitment that the handler, in my case, that I would have had to put in if my dog had had some kind of injury. So these dogs do their jobs for us every day, whether it's guiding us from place to place, whether it's for someone in a wheelchair, picking up things or pulling the chair. Their job is to be with us and to help us. And to have had someone intentionally try to harm my dog was very upsetting. I would also just add that the thing that happened to me after this incident was people started to tell me stories that had happened to them. Even though I thought this was a unique kind of situation, a coworker of mine told me a couple of stories. She's a wheelchair user, and she has a service dog who helps her balance, who helps her pick up things, helps her transfer. He's now retired, but in his work life, he had two incidents happen to him where a woman with a child ran a baby stroller into him because the handler would not let the woman pet the dog. And the child was in the mother's child was in the stroller at the time she ran it into the dog. And the second incident was where another woman's totally different incident came up and kicked the dog and then laughed as she walked away. These things do happen. They don't happen often, but when they do happen, they can create serious and long-term impact on both the dog and the handler. And that's why we're here today.
Thank you, Ms. Lansky. Any questions? Sir Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Lansky. I'm just wondering, the request for the change in the language from the situations that you've described, it seems like the language we already had in statute that prohibits someone from harming, from causing bodily harm to a service animal. So the change that was already the law. It seems like the change that we're being asked to make is that we would add, otherwise render the animal unable to perform its duties. And I'm not quite sure the reason that language is needed or what that's intended to refer to. I'm wondering, if it might be like, say, for example, someone who tied up the dog. I mean, is that the intent here? Or what was that intended to get at? Additional language.
Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair and members, the intent of the language is to recognize that sometimes when a service animal is assaulted, the evidence of bodily harm isn't as apparent, but so it's lowering the threshold a little bit, but the ability for the service animal to perform its duties is impaired. So, you know, so that this threshold, the standard of bodily harm, you know, is a little bit more difficult to show, but it's fairly easy to show, as Ms. Lieski described, you know, the dog on a temporary and perhaps an ongoing basis isn't able to do what it needs to do so that its handler, its owner, can get about their business. That's a fairly significant impact on that person. Likewise, I mean, I don't know if I don't know about the hypothetical that you proposed, but if someone were to grab someone's dog and go tie it up, that would be a pretty bad thing.
Sarah Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble. And I agree. I mean, if a dog is being used, I'm just trying to think of, you know, from the lawyer hat standpoint, how broadly this language was, first of all, intended by you to be used, but even also if you put something in statute, what it might possibly be used to encompass. And so even though a person shouldn't interfere with someone's use of their service dog in any way, I just am thinking if this is a gross misdemeanor, we've talked about proportionality and the different kinds of things a person might do, and whether the level of the offense is or the behavior is consistent with the degree of the penalty. So that was my question, and maybe there would be something, for example, less serious about someone who interfered with use as opposed to someone who actually harmed the dog. And then my second question had to do with the restitution, and I'm just wondering from Ms. Pontius or Mr. Backus if there are other situations in the law where we make it a mandatory for restitution to be imposed by a court, or if that's usually something that is in the court's discretion. I'm not sure.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond to the first question.
Okay, first part, sir.
This is the Judiciary Committee. I don't sit and listen to these, you know, kind of weighing proportionality against, you know, degree of you know, how we construe the degree of the crime committed. So I don't have the same frame of reference that you all as experts do. But I will suggest that to eliminate an individual's ability to use their service animal for 5 minutes or forever would be comparable to preventing you from being able to move. You know, if you were confined in a store against your will, for example, that would be, you know, by a stranger, that would be a pretty serious occurrence for a minute or longer. I mean, that's the degree of impact that this has on people's ability to move around in the world and move around with some security and confidence. So, you know, I don't know if that means gross misdemeanor. It means felony to me, but.
Mr. Backus asked the point on mandatory restitution. Do we have comparable legislation that you're aware of?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, it's relatively rare to have the mandatory restitution. However, it does appear on occasion. And most notable here, Section 609.226, which is harm caused by a dog. There's a provision there where if your dog harms a service dog, in that case there is mandatory restitution. And this language in this bill is based on that mandatory restitution. And if I could also point out for Senator Olson, you asked before about the being unable to perform its duties. That concept is also built in that other statute as well. So that's where it comes from here.
We do have another witness here at the table. Could you please identify yourself for the record?
And Mr. Chair, if I may, I need to correct myself. I made a transgression earlier. This is Chris Bell from the American Council of the Blind, not the National Federation of the Blind. But I'm happy to say that the American Council and National Federation agree on this bill, and we have a letter from the National Federation. I don't know if it's at your places that supports this bill.
Okay. Well, please identify yourself for the record, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Moa, and members of the committee. My name is Christopher Bell. I am the chairperson of the American Council of the Blind's Committee on Advocacy and Legislative Affairs. I'd like to address Senator Olson's point. First, as has been noted, the language about rendering a service animal unable to perform its duties and the mandatory restitution is already in the criminal code, but only with regard to attacks by dogs on service animals. It is not in Section 340 or Chapter 343 regarding prevention of cruelty to animals, and 343.21 in that chapter is what we are seeking to amend so that it's really parallel. Secondly, when these incidents occur, if there is a prosecution, the weighing of the particular facts of the incidents and the gravity of the incident is something that's done by the court and the trier of fact. And that is, of course, why in the existing law, the penalties for imprisonment, a fine, or both are discretionary with the judge based upon the nature of the incident. So the nature of the incident and the seriousness of the incident automatically is taken into account by the court, just as it is for any other criminal act. In this bill, in Senate File 2990, the criminal penalties relating to imprisonment and the fine are not things that we have changed in 2990. That comes directly from the existing section of Chapter 343.21. The only thing that was changed in that is it is stated that if a dog is rendered unable to perform its duties, then that is a gross misdemeanor, because that disjunctive or rendered unable to perform its duties is something that we added, and therefore there did need to be a parallel in the statute for penalties. Lastly, mandatory restitution, actually under the Minnesota Crime Victims Bill of Rights Act, restitution is to be available to victims of crime. So I don't really think this is really a departure in policy for the legislature. It's more simply tracking what is available under Section 609.226. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chairman,
I'd like to move the bill.
Okay. Is there anybody else who's here on the bill? Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment. The A1 amendment.
Okay.
I think it needs to be passed out. And we've discussed this with Senator Dibble, and it reflects language, I believe, of legislation that Senator Foley has had. I want to say that I think we intended on line 1.20 of the amendment that would be a gross misdemeanor. That was what I had intended. Kind of following with the above reference parens B, the purchasing of a ticket or getting admission to animal fights, that
so
having the devices or things that enhance an animal's ability to fight is guilty of a gross misdemeanor, and I think.
Senator Dibble, have you seen the A1 amendment?
A version of it. I'm familiar with the language, and I'm comfortable.
Okay. Have you received a copy of it?
And actually, Mr. Chairman, I think what Senator Dibble had seen placed it had different placement, but this is, I think, more appropriate placement.
Okay.
Did you want to have any testimony?
Well, there's somebody at the table, apparently. Did you wish to testify on the A1 amendment?
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Dan Nijelic, manager of Minneapolis Animal Care and Control.
What's your name again?
Dan Nijelic.
Okay.
Manager of Minneapolis Animal Care and Control for the City of Minneapolis. For the past 2 years, we've spent a lot of time and effort making sure our resources are focused on public safety, and one of those parts is dealing with aggressive and dangerous animals, ensuring they're in compliance with state statute and Minneapolis ordinance, as well as dealing with a lot of animal cruelty issues. And one thing we see over and over again is a strong connection between animal cruelty, of which dog fighting and animal fighting is, and the level of crime we see in our communities. And its connection, it's seen in research, it's also seen in the streets. streets of our communities. Animal fighting, animal cruelty is definitely connected and correlated with the violence we see in our communities. And one of the things that we've looked at and worked on is trying to address some of the dog fighting issues going on in Minneapolis, as well as some of the cockfighting issues going on. And there's a letter here from a, just to show some of the community impact. Excellent. The letter's going around. It definitely has an impact on community, but also seeing that a lot of times people think that dog fighting and cock fighting is it's an animal issue, but it's really it's a people issue too. It has a direct impact on people in terms of their sensitivity to cruelty and their involvement in other criminal activity. As we've worked on cases involving dog fighting, we clearly see the connection between dog fighting and other criminal activity. On a warrant we did last year on a dog fighting case, it was done in conjunction with the narcotics unit of the Minneapolis Police Department because, of course, the connection between gambling, dog fighting, and narcotics in that. It clearly has an impact on the violence in our community. As research has shown, its connection between people's connection to that and that. And just some of the things that we're looking at, and there's been some questions about, you know, are we going after, you know, what type of things are we going after? These are clearly items that would only be used if you were trying to enhance an animal's fighting. In terms of cockfighting, these would be placed on as spurs on chickens so they can inflict greater harm on another animal. What this here is, and it's not all the way out, but it's called a spring pull, and the idea is to have a dog hang there for a long period of time to build up its jaw and its neck strength. And clearly, there's really no purpose for that except for the infliction of harm on something else, whether it be an animal or a person. And so clearly, these are items that aren't going to the average person who might be using a treadmill to condition their animal, which some people do. These items in total are clearly reflecting somebody tending to engage in criminal activity, and that criminal activity has a connection to the level of violence that we're seeing in our communities. This tool will give us some additional ability. When you're dealing with dogfighting, it's a very below the radar. We've been working on cases, and what they do now is they basically call a fight, and then when people meet, and then they give a location, they drive to. It's very difficult to really get inside. We are able to do warrants and come away with the paraphernalia. It's very difficult to actually get into a fight situation, which is what a felony is. This would give us the ability to really make a difference. Are we going to see a lot of cases? No, but it's going to send a very strong message that this is not accepted in our cities and our communities and will have a direct impact on the level of violence we see in our communities. I thank you for your time.
One question I've got, Mr. Nijelic, is I'm just wondering if the language is a bit vague, and if it's vague, that raises questions as to whether constitutionally you can hold people accountable for criminal conduct when it's, I mean, a device or structure to enhance an animal's ability to fight. You may fully understand what it is, but unless law enforcement, and particularly the people who are charged with this, fully understand it, as they say it, I can see a possible challenge to this language.
Mr. Chair, I think that's always going to be a question about it. I think that from a law enforcement standpoint, we would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that, in fact, an act of crime has been committed in terms of what the purpose of those were for. But, yeah, the courts would – we'd have to make our case that these items are being used to enhance an animal for a fight. In that case, we might also have an animal that has been or will be fought to show that this how this stuff is being used, because we will a lot of times – when we're picking up this paraphernalia, also take a dog out of there that clearly have the scars that are consistent with an animal that's been fought before. But, yeah, this would – it the burden of proof would still rely on law enforcement to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this is being used to enhance an animal's ability to fight.
But as I said, I mean, you gave an example of a treadmill. And if somebody owns a treadmill, is that enhancing an animal's ability to fight or not? And as I say, if the language is vague and it's declared unconstitutional, you're no further off, you're no better off having this on the books. So I'm just pointing that out to you, that I'm not quite sure that this gets you where you want to be, but this is the language we've got here. So, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's important to point out that they would have to show, the prosecution would have to show intent to use it. So that's.
Okay. Senator Scheid, you wanted to...
I do.
You wanted
I want to
move
add
the,
gross.
Okay, so you move the A1 amendment, and on page 1, line 20...
in front of misdemeanor.
After the word A and before misdemeanor, add the word gross. Okay, that will be incorporated. Is there discussion on the amendment?
Sure.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scheid, does gross misdemeanor, does that change any financial costs?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
I don't know that. I guess we already have that the gross misdemeanor above it in parens B. I don't know if I can quantify it. It sounds like it's not very prevalent, but it's there. And
well, the underlying bill does create a gross misdemeanor, and this does yeah. too. So if that generates a fiscal note, you know they're out. The bill's going to have to take some. So, is there discussion on the A1 amendment as modified? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Is further discussion on the bill? Is there anybody else who wants to be heard on the bill?
Senator
Moore has moved that Senate file 2990 as amended be recommended to pass, and I believe it has to go to the Ag Committee.
Mr. Chair, I don't, because we the bill came to, as introduced, came to Judiciary, and we haven't scheduled it, so we don't know who else might want to see this kind of a bill fits into the statute of the law that the Ag Committee would want to look at. So we could certainly send it to the floor, but I just want to give Senator Dibble a forewarning that if the Ag Committee protests and say they'd like to see it, that you may have to go deal with them.
And Senator Moore, I don't know how it would get there. There's a floor session tomorrow at 11, so technically... If it was referred there, it would be referred to the Ag Committee, and then they have to see it tomorrow. I think tomorrow is the only last meeting they've got before the second deadline. So, I suppose. Well, what's the pleasure? Send it to the floor.
I don't mind sending it to the floor, Mr. Chair. I just want to give with this the underlying bill didn't have to go. This amendment, the Scheid amendment, though, may send it there. So I just want to give Senator Dibble the heads up that that's not within my control. But I will send it to the floor as part of my motion.
Yeah, what I would suggest to be done is send it to the floor and probably check tomorrow morning with Senator Vickerman's office. If he decides to see the bill, there's still time at the 11 o'clock floor session tomorrow to redirect the bill to his committee, but it'd have to be heard tomorrow, I would think, but to make deadlines. So.
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I know in the other chamber they did not need to see it in that committee. So,
but
you
I...
know.
I don't know if Senator Vickerman wants to see it or not. So Senator Ma moves that Senate File 2990 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there a discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Dibble. I'm sorry for the delay, and I'm apologies
you,
to the
Chair members.
Other service dog individuals who had to leave early. So let's return to Senate File 2725. I don't know if we've got any more discussion on the underlying bill. We did want to talk about the traveling data provisions that had been Senate File 3163, but were now part of the A4 amendment. So I did have some people that had signed up. Teresa Nelson, Richard Neumeister, Colleen Rawley, and Don Gemberling wanted to testify in that provision. So if those witnesses wish to come forward, now is the time to do it. We've had a description of the A4 amendment already.
Mr. Chair, while the witnesses are coming up to the table, I think for purposes of the public, I'd like to finish up this bill, then we should take our dinner break. So for people who are waiting for the other bills, why don't we just let them know that we'll be back here? I don't know, depending on when we're done, but we'll be back.
I imagine it will not be before 7 o'clock. Okay, so for the remaining items on the agenda, we will not be getting them before 7 p.m. So if you're waiting for other bills, you can take a time to take a break, go get some dinner or whatever right now, but we will not be getting the other bills before 7. It might be after 7, but we will not be before 7. Okay, so who do we have on? Okay, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Nelson, and I'm legal counsel of the ACLU of Minnesota. We're the statewide affiliate of the American Civil Liberties Union, and we have over 11,000 members here in the state of Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to discuss our concerns relating to traveling law enforcement data. This issue really does arise in the broader context of the discussion of the collection of criminal intelligence data. We would like to have a thoughtful conversation about criminal intelligence data in general because we have concerns about the collection of data, about criminal intelligence data for fighting crime without individualized suspicion. This type of dragnet burdens First Amendment rights to free expression and association. It burdens the Fourth Amendment right to privacy, and it burdens the Fifth Amendment right to due process to correct errors. I'd like to start, though, by providing you with some context for the ACLU of Minnesota's concerns about traveling law enforcement data. First, Minnesota has one of the best laws in the nation regarding government data practices. The law balances the needs of law enforcement to conduct confidential criminal investigations with the rights of data subjects to learn about and to correct information that is held about themselves and the rights of the public to know about the actions of government officials. Our law does a great job of balancing all of those competing interests. While Minnesota's law enforcement community is highly professional and ethical, examples of improper spying on political groups abound throughout the nation. They're too numerous to list here, but I'll give you just a couple examples. First, an inadvertent disclosure by prosecutors in a criminal case exposed widespread spying of peaceful protesters by the Denver Police Department. When the ACLU of Colorado investigated this incident, they learned that in addition to collecting all of this data, for example, data about the license plate numbers of all the vehicles of people attending peaceful protests, the Denver Police Department was also sharing that data with law enforcement agencies across the country. When the ACLU started addressing the issue, they learned there was nothing in Colorado law that would prohibit them from doing so. There was also the 28 CFR Part 23. Certainly, the Denver Police Department was violating that federal guideline, but there's no there's no private cause of action under that statute. So even though they tried to sue under that statute, that issue was dismissed by the court. They did ultimately get a consent decree in that in their lawsuit when the Denver Police Department decided to change its policies. A lawsuit by the ACLU of Maryland exposed a Maryland State Police spying operation that targeted lawful protest activity. In this case, it was under the guise of investigating terrorist threats. The MSP was assigning covert agents to infiltrate local anti-war and anti-death penalty groups. As a result of the monitoring, MSP placed 53 peaceful activists on official terrorism databases, including two Catholic nuns, members of the Maryland Campaign to End the Death Penalty, and a Democratic candidate for local police, or for, I'm sorry, for local political office. We understand that there are situations when Minnesota law enforcement agencies will have a need to receive data from other states. However, given these examples of what happens in other states, we believe that it's important to ensure that Minnesota's strong data practices provisions apply to data received from these other states. If, for example, Minnesota were to receive data from the Maryland State Police that included all of these this information about the activists that they collected in the course of a criminal investigation, the operation of Minnesota Data Practices Law would allow the data subject and the public to learn about that data collection. And that sunlight would allow those data subjects to pursue violations, pursue remedies for violations of their First Amendment rights. If, on the other hand, the data is to be treated under the laws of the sending state, and the sending state requires that data to remain confidential, even if the investigation is inactive, then the data subject will never learn that Minnesota has data about their lawful protest activities. We think that's a problem. The Delete Everything amendment that Senator Moore has offered today, I think, does go a long way toward addressing the problem because it limits the data that gets sent to Minnesota to criminal investigative data, and it defines it as that data that's collected as part of an investigation to prepare a case against a person for the commission of a crime. The problem is, what do we do with investigative data that is received by Minnesota that does not become part of an active investigation here in Minnesota? Under current law, the data would be classified as public. That's a problem. And under this bill, we would simply apply the sending state's classification to the data. Neither option really is appropriate in our minds. Obviously, the sending state is not going to send data that they will believe, that they believe will be made public if they've still got an active investigation. But to apply the sending state's data practices provisions or the sending state's classification, the data could result in a requirement that Minnesota forever keep confidential the inappropriate collection of lawful protest activity by another state in the context of one of their criminal investigations. We respectfully urge this committee to address this problem by first applying Minnesota data practices principles to the issue. The presumption should be that data from another state be treated as it would be treated in Minnesota, as if the data originated in Minnesota. Thus, if the data is not part of an active criminal investigation in the sending state, it should be treated as inactive criminal investigative data in Minnesota. And if it is part of an active criminal investigation in the sending state, it should be treated as active criminal investigative data here in Minnesota. Once the criminal investigation is no longer active, then it should be treated as Minnesota treats that inactive data.
Mr. Chair, we do that in the amendment. Mr. Chair, I just want...
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I, with all due respect, Madam Senator Moore, I think the amendment doesn't go far enough to address that issue because it says if it becomes an active... If it's part of an active criminal investigation in Minnesota, then our provisions apply. But it does nothing to address data that's coming from another state that Minnesota doesn't incorporate into an active investigative file. If that's what we're doing, I don't think that we would need the language that says that we're incorporating the other state's data provisions. The other thing that we would recommend is that Minnesota incorporate protections for data subjects that are stronger than Minnesota's laws. So, for example, if another state's laws provide greater protection for a data subject to access information about themselves or to keep that information private when it's not relevant to a criminal investigation, then those provisions should apply, which brings me now back to my first point regarding the broader discussion about what needs to take place regarding the collection and use of criminal intelligence data. The ACLU of Minnesota firmly believes that the state of Minnesota should not be collecting data from other states unless that data was collected in a manner that respects and complies with the constitutional requirements of the First, Fourth, Fifth, and 14th Amendments, and we would urge you to ensure that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Nielsen. Any questions? Mr. Kimberling.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moa, my name is Don Gemberling, and today I'm actually here representing a group, which is new for me. That group is the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. The coalition has been around for about 25 years. Until recently, our major activity was to annually give the John R. Finnegan Freedom of Information Award, and we actually did that today, because today is, interestingly enough, Freedom of Information Day. In Minnesota and across the country. In recent years, the Minnesota Coalition for Government Information, we call it MNCOGI, we got an acronym like everybody else. COGI has broadened its membership. We have librarians, we have just plain citizens, we have attorneys, we have journalists, we have some education types, and part of what we're trying to do is to have a greater voice in how you folks make public policy. And that's why I'm here today, because for a variety of reasons, the board of the directors of which I am a member decided I should be the public face of the Coalition on Government Information. I think I probably got picked to do that because, as some of you know, I've been working on issues of government information for about 37 years. I should never talk like that. It shows how old you are. In this particular instance, I also have some related experience because for about 5 years before I started working with government information issues, I actually did work in criminal justice information systems. Okay, I spent a year at the BCA helping them convert paper files on criminal histories into computerized files, and I did other stuff. So the things I want to focus on today are essentially the parts of the traveling data section that I think present really problematic issues and some real serious changes in policy that I think you want to think about. Since 1979, one of the strongest parts of the Data Practices Act and a major premise of the act on which the whole, from which the whole act flows is the idea that, except for deferring in some cases to federal law, the Minnesota legislature makes all decisions about how data are classified. We use a very different system than that which is used in most other states. Those other states use what is called an exemption system, in which you have very broad exemptions, and bureaucrats basically decide whether or not information fits into an exemption. In the bill, what you accept if you pass the bill is a policy that says when data comes to us from a law enforcement agency in another state, 49 other states, not counting territories, we're going to accept their classification of the data until such time as the data moves into an active investigative file in a law enforcement agency. So you're deferring, in a sense, to policy made by 49 other bodies such as yours, but you're also deferring to policy made by administrators in 49 other states interpreting how their law fits the data they send to Minnesota. Now, one of the issues with our Data Practices Act has always been the complexity of the act, and I would suggest by accepting that approach, you're really adding a new level of complexity. Let me give you an illustration. One of the things I used to do was I used to do a lot of training. I once was invited to do some training in southwest Minnesota, and the guy who signed me up said, you're going to train 9 police departments. I thought, oh, this is cool, because part of what I tried to do was go to as lot of many people as possible. Well, when I got to the room, there were 9 people in the room. Those were the 9 police departments in southwestern Minnesota who came to the class. The guy was the chief. I think they also swept the office. They did everything for that police department. And I'm not quite sure how folks like that are going to deal with this kind of language and interpreting something. And keep in mind, this was in southwestern Minnesota, where they might be getting data from both South Dakota and Iowa on a fairly routine basis. So one of the issues is the larger issue that Ms. Nelson raised about behind this is the whole issue of intelligence data, okay, and how to handle intelligence data. And that's an issue that I used to discuss with the BCA, not on a regular basis, but on a basis starting back in actually 1982 was the first time they ever raised an issue with me. And the problem is in our current Data Practices Act, intelligence data just doesn't fit, okay? And intelligence data, as you've heard today, has a lot of controversy associated with it. But one of the problems here is that this won't deal with intelligence data. And at some point, you're going to have to deal with that. And I think Senator Moore is prepared to deal with that at some point. But that issue will still remain. So the last issue, Ms. Nelson alluded to it, it's not clear, based on the language of the bill, where rights of subjective data fit. You know, one of the things the legislature did back in 1974 was to establish a principle that when the government maintains information on people in this state, those people have a right to know that the government is maintaining information about them. Part of the reason for that idea was abuses of intelligence data in the late 1960s and 1970s. It was a way of at least letting people know that they're in a government database. Now, under current law, that's about all they can get to find out if that database has confidential data. So, in closing, you heard from Mr. Franklin, and I really appreciated his testimony, about taking time to make a good decision. And what I recommend to you, strangely enough, is the model that was used to create the current Minnesota statute, Section 1382. That's the law enforcement data section. And here's the model that was used. The legislature said, we got to do something about this. They started saying that in 1979. For 3 years following the legislature putting a sunset date in the statute, representatives of law enforcement, and I mean all law enforcement, the media, county attorneys, sat down for a couple-year period and basically tried to come to agreement as to how to handle those things. And, you know, they ended up not cutting the deal. But what they did is they came up with some guiding principles that some of us could take and turn into a deal. And that's Section 1382, basically subdivisions 1 through 8 or 9. And that section, strangely enough, has essentially been unchanged since 1980. And it stood the public well, and I think it stood law enforcement well in all situations. And I recommend it as a model to you, not to let people go in back rooms and make deals, but to come forward to you with some principles that you might be able to use to make some legislation that works for everybody and protects things like governmental accountability and rights of people. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there any questions? Thank you. We've got also Colleen Raleigh and Richard Neumeister. Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Neumeister. I oppose the traveling classification data section. Some of the points have already been stated, I think, very clearly. But one of the points I just want to make is that this is a complex issue, and it's not one, and there's different points of view. And I do believe that there can be some solutions in this. And what I just want to end, because the points have been made, the consequences of sharing intelligence and investigative data on people without accountability and transparency is that the right of privacy and civil liberties do not fare well. History tells us this. And so there are a number of questions from my perspective about the traveling data section that has been brought up. But then the other issues that have not been is some of the accountability standards that has not been taught. One of the things that, if this bill is going to move forward, if there's a push to have this section go forward, I think in detail it has to say some of the things that have been articulated by the previous speakers, that it will, that when you ask an agency about confidential data that may come from another state, your state's rights apply here in Minnesota. If the data comes as part of investigative data, you do get access to that if it becomes investigative data and it tells you that. But there's a lot of questions, and that's where I would encourage some aspect of a discussion further down the line. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are some points that I raised.
Thank you. Any questions? Ms. Raleigh?
Thank you. I'm Colleen Raleigh, a retired FBI agent, and the last 13 years or so of my career here in the Minneapolis FBI, I was the FOIA and Privacy Act officer. I also had a chance to really come to grips and see the failure to connect the dots, which I know there was a question earlier about why, you know, why do these failure to connect the dots and put the emphasis on connecting the dots as opposed to collecting and retaining dots. The key, I think, because I give lectures on effective investigation and civil liberties, the key is relevancy of the records and pertinence. And, you know, law enforcement will tell you that even in a cold case, if they find a pertinent record that's been kept for 20 years, they might be able to solve the case. But it's those are the key things, and they actually don't only help people's rights, but they help solve cases. Now, when you're at the beginning of an investigation, and certainly if you launch an intelligence collection where you may not even have a crime, we were talking about kind of the elephant in the room, which is intelligence, which is we're trying to prevent a future crime. We may not even have a crime that has occurred. But if we're talking about a crime, investigative data, a crime that's already occurred, even so, at the beginning of an investigation is where you have the collection of your least accurate records, partially because that's when the police don't even have a suspect necessarily, and it's just as you get further along in the criminal process, and certainly when you get into court, that's when your records become much more accurate because you have a chance to prove and you can show your evidence. So going back to this idea of how you can do it right and help law enforcement solve cases and also keep people's civil liberties and constitutional rights. We heard the ACLU mention several scandals that have occurred in the past few years, partially because massive intelligence collections have been launched in many states. So she listed just a handful of these cases that have cropped up around the country. I'm going to list a couple of failures on the other side, where they did fail still to connect the dots. Even after 9/11, we just had the Hassan shooting, law enforcement, and there's an investigation now in the federal agencies as to why there were many dots and why these dots were not connected. There's also an investigation of prior to the Hassan case, or afterwards, the Nigerian Abdul Muttalib. There's another investigation of why those dots were not connected. It doesn't help to collect massive and non-relevant intelligence, because if you are trying to connect these dots, the only things that matter are relevant things. And so when I talk, I try to explain how this actually hurts law enforcement efforts to open the floodgates to more massive intelligence. I have two concerns specifically about this bill. One is just very minor, in that it says that you would treat the information that is sent, the key word here is sent, from another state. And, you know, with fusion centers and the sharing right now, it's actually possible that Minnesota could send its information to another state's fusion center, and then that state could send it back. Again, we're trying to share information, so that's certainly a possibility. That little word could be easily corrected by saying data that emanates from a law enforcement agency in another state that would originate.
Where in the A4 amendment do you see the word? I'm looking for it.
Where am I talking from?
Yeah, the word sent.
I'm talking from the amendment, Section 2, Subdivision 2.
What line, on the left
third,
side?
The third line where it says...
it says 1 point something.
It says, except as provided in paragraph B or C, when a law enforcement agency in Minnesota receives investigative data from a law enforcement agency in another state. And my point is, when you say it's from another law enforcement agency, it's kind of a little bit unfar-fetched, but that agency might not be the originating agency of the information. It might have gotten its information even from Minnesota, or certainly from other states, because we have these fusion centers going on. For instance, a citizen could be actually traveling back and forth, let's say between Minnesota and Illinois, and so they would develop a system now of sharing information between two different law enforcement agencies, and the Illinois law enforcement agency may end up with some information that was originally from Minnesota. It's just a very minor point.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, on that point, Ms. Raleigh, if you know, based on how these fusion centers operate, will it always be clear when we get data from another state which state law should control if there's a kind of amalgamation of information from multiple states?
Ms. Raleigh?
No. You know, I'm not 100% clear on how the fusion center information comes. I'm assuming that it does identify the origin, at least, because in order to track it to see, you know, if somebody's following up on it, they'd have to see where the origin of that piece of information is, but I don't know for sure.
Okay, please proceed.
Continue?
Yes.
Okay, my last concern is along the lines of what Teresa Nelson just mentioned, which is when you're allowing the other state to say what it... I guess the information, let me point to the line here. It's a Section 2, Subdivision 2, Line 4, and it says that the data are classified in Minnesota in a manner that is the equivalent to the data classification or treatment of the data in the other state.
That's page 1, line 21 or 22. Go ahead.
And when it says, when it's equivalent to the data classification or treatment of the data, I think many other states would probably say it was collected in the course of a criminal investigation, and that's the end. They do not have the same system of looking at it later to say, well, it was never pertinent, it was not relevant. Last year, when the more massive proposal for creating an intelligence category was made, there actually was a proposal for a system of going back after a year and looking at the data to see if it was relevant, and actually a little process whereby people would deem it, you know, deem it still non-public. And that, of course, is not in this bill, but in essence, unless you go treat the data along the lines of Minnesota, it hasn't led to a active criminal investigation in Minnesota. So if it did lead to a active criminal investigation in Minnesota, then, of course, it would remain non-public. But let's say it didn't. After 2 years, after 3 years, there's no provision in here to go and look at it now and say, is it still pertinent? Is it still relevant? There's no way of clearing out your database. And, you know, I was listening to the testimony about the gang strike force. What you can end up is, after a while, you have your database now, you know, really containing a lot of inaccurate records, as theirs did. And that's the other concern I had.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I wonder if Ms. Pontius would speak to line 1.22 of the amendment, and in particular the language that says, after the treatment of the data in the other state, and then the language says, that applies at the time a request for access to the data in Minnesota is made. Because I was, contrary to all the other testifiers, the ACLU did make an effort to share their concerns with me. And I asked Ms. Pontius to help address some of those concerns by putting in the language on line 1.22. So I wonder if Ms. Pontius could talk to the committee about where that language came from and why we put it there.
Ms. Pontius?
Mr. Chairman and members, this is language that's kind of derived from current law that applies when Minnesota data changes classification. So when you make a request for access, it's the classification of the data at the time that the request is made that applies. This just states that this is intended so that if the data from the other state, let's say it was an active investigation that would normally be treated as confidential data, comes to Minnesota, but then after it comes to Minnesota becomes inactive and accessible to the public in the other state, then it would be its treatment at the time of the request for access to the data that would apply. So it would pick up the change in classification in the other state.
But our Minnesota, of course, has that law, but other states may not. That was my point, is the other state may actually say all investigative data, if it's collected originally, remains non-public. And they don't have that later look at it to say, well, it never led to an active investigation. As long as it was initially collected for this purpose, it remains secret forever. And that was my question.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, yeah, and I wasn't responding to that issue.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Anybody else who's here on the traveling data part? Okay, what about the bill, folks? Do we have somebody else? Sure. Okay. Come on forward. And okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, go get your son. Or
can I go get him?
Yeah. Go get your son.
Mitchell, get him.
I apologize.
He didn't go far.
He was getting a little antsy, and I didn't want it to.
Yeah, I understand. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Carrie Ann Johnson, and basically, I feel that I will be a person who could be somebody who would be subject to this bill. Which is why I feel the need to just speak up. It's something that came up really quickly, so I apologize. I haven't had time to investigate it in as full detail as some people, but I pretty much wanted to support the testimony that has been heard so far already by the ACLU and by Colleen Rowley's just now. I just want to lend some credence to the fact that I support what they are saying regarding this. I definitely think this needs to go back to the drawing board. This needs oversight. I really am concerned about the loophole provision that could allow for data to come out of Minnesota, go to another state, and then come back and then be sealed in private. Personally, I am an activist, somebody who is fighting for a better world for my child and for all of our children. So we have a place that is perhaps without dirty coal, a place that is free of rainforest deforestation. And I could not say to what end any particular private influence might be behind what's going on in terms of whose data they're capturing and what the motivation is behind that. I have friends of mine who are in jail right now, detained by secret federal juries without any explanation as to what is going on, and it's only been revealed without time. That in fact, the new thing just happened last night, apparently, with the FBI jailing somebody again for something that they believe that he was part of. But this was all something that was gotten because of this kind of state transferring of data. So again, I'm just going to keep this very brief, and I just want to speak as somebody, as you can see, I'm a mom. If something like this were to come up, if I were somebody because I retweeted something, for instance, and it happened to be something that they determined was something that was probable cause, just because I retweeted something that I got a link to an article about something, I could be taken away from my son, who I'm nursing and trying to take care of. And this friend of mine that I don't even know very well, but just somebody that I know as a fellow activist, she was 15 at the time the person I'm speaking of right now, so she was not even involved in this, and yet they're holding her. She's already been detained for 6 months without charges, and that's the kind of thing that could be a result of this. So I understand that there's good intentions behind this, but I really think this needs to go to the drawing board and make sure that people really, really make sure there's some regulation and some oversight on this.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Any questions?
Thank you.
Sir, go ahead.
My name is Nathaniel Kalik. I'm the president of the St. Paul NAACP. I'm also the chair of the Minnesota-Dakota State Conference of the NAACP Legal Redress Committee. I come before you today, and I want to thank Senator Moore and the committee for allowing me at the last minute to come and make a few brief comments. I was born and raised in the Summit University area, and for the last 30 years, we've been fighting for our community. We've been fighting for public safety, and we've been fighting against injustices being perpetrated by the criminal justice system. And we've worked long and hard to try to strike a balance. We've worked with folks like Commissioner Mike Champion when he was an agent. We've had a pretty good relationship with the Homicide Division over the years with the St. Paul Police Department. We at the NAACP has posted rewards for crimes being committed in our community, and the most recent was a triple homicide in the Rice Street area. So we don't take crime lightly. We don't believe in coddling individuals that work against our best interests. But we do want a balance, and we demand fairness. Since 1997, the state has collected data on folks in our community, and many of them look like me. This data has been a secret covert operation where the folks were not notified. And I think one of the greatest transgression of this database collection, whether it was Pointer File or GangNet, that children under the age of 18 was not even notified. And most of the people on those databases look like us and came from our community. And I'm here today to ask that, number one, you consider striking the gang database, whether it's the Pointer File and GangNet. And number two, this new criminal intelligence bill, before it finalized, have some of the partners from the community to be at the table to discuss this. I think it's in everybody's best interest. As you know, Minnesota has one of the highest disparities rates in the criminal justice system. And part of that is because the system has been unfair, and it has not been blind justice. And so we're here today to seek a place at the table before this bill or any other bill dealing with data collection is finalized. And I would hope that in the future that there would be an early warning system that could be sent out to the communities that are affected most by what's being proposed here today. But at the very least, we think that the gang database as it's presently situated should be dismantled, should be terminated, and there should be a new discussion for data collection, whether it's criminal intelligence or any other level. And I would just hope that the leadership of the Senate and the House would include us to be part of that discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kleek. Any questions of the witness? Okay. Anybody else who wants to be heard of the bill? Sir Moore.
Mr. Chair, there's been a lot of conversations about criminal intelligence data bills, and you know that you're the chief author of that bill, and that bill is not on the agenda today. And part of the reason for that is because I have heard, and you have heard, we have all heard from the people who have been testifying about their concerns about criminal intelligence databases. And so that's the project that is an interim project that we will take advantage of this interim to work with all the different stakeholders who are up here to look at your bill and to have a conversation about that. And so I would appreciate the members helping us get the data traveling information through. Our local law enforcement needs this to continue to operate the work that they're doing today. It doesn't mean that it's signed, sealed, and delivered, but at least we're providing a framework for our local our law enforcement to do their work. We can always come back to revisit it in the context of the other conversation, but nothing in here deals with creating any criminal intelligence databases. And I think Mr. Johnson might have some words to wrap us up, but
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair and members, I'll be very brief, and I was going to reiterate what Senator Moore has just said, that I think there's been some confusion here in terminology, and I would like to point out to members that this clearly is talking about investigative data using a definition that is already exists in 1382 subdivision 7. And so we're talking about a very limited scope of data. Number two, we're trying to close a gap in which other states are unwilling to share this type of data in Minnesota because they have no reliance on how it's going to be treated. That is to the detriment of citizens in the state of Minnesota. And finally, number three, I think it's important to remember that in a number of presentations I've made to this committee and other committees here at the legislature, one of your concerns has been what happens when we send data outside of the Minnesota, from Minnesota to other states, and the desire of this body to have it treated in the same way that you've decided it should be treated when it leaves the state of Minnesota. And part of the genesis of this is to ensure to other states that we are equally respectful of decisions that they may have made. And with that, I'll close my comments.
Thank you. Discussion on the bill. Senator Limmer.
One last question. Your last comment talked about information from the state of Minnesota going to other states, and we would prefer they would treat it as well as we do. But how would we enforce that if a state did release the data?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, that's a wonderful question, and I wish I had a magic answer for that right now, other than the fact that I would say from a procedural standpoint, if we found out, the state found out that they weren't, we would make sure that we informed people who provided that data that they cannot rely on the fact that they're not honoring that commitment to do that. Outside of that, at this moment, Senator, I don't have a better answer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we've had numerous discussions about this very issue over the years, and even as early as last week. And I don't think there is any way that the state can enforce our data privacy laws on subjects of Minnesota, subject data, the identifying information, once it goes beyond our boundaries, and it's rather hard to keep it in an internet world, to keep it in the boundaries of Minnesota, we can't. And so, and likewise, probably with other states sending information here.
Well, the only thing I could say to that, Mr. Chair and Senator, is the fact that if this body enacted such a rule that you see in this statute, it would be incumbent upon us to follow that rule. And in good faith, I believe Minnesota law enforcement would do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 2725 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee.
Dis- Discussion of the motion. Hearing none. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Moa, we're in recess until 7 o'clock? Or how long?
7:15.
Okay, we are in recess until 7:15.
I hope she's already gone for the